grant for the tier one contract. So we will schedule that with you. So from those 47, here you see basically the highest performing scenarios that we have. And basically just looking at what you have color-coded, you have two managed lanes that you can see that was identified in all of the scenarios, as well as a component of transit was represented as well. So this is basically what came out. And the highest performing basically looked at meeting the purpose and needs elements that we had laid out in the Tier 1 process. So in May and June of last year, the CTB resolution advanced all 10 concepts for further consideration. And a record of decision was approved by the Federal Highway Administration in November of 2013. Some of the significant findings from the ROD, basically, or determinations from the ROD, was that the transit and highway component could move on separate tracks, should we choose to. As long as it met those criteria, basically dealing with logical termini, independent utilities, and making sure that we didn't restrict the advancement of one concept over another, should we want to consider that in the future. Also, an important component was to study tolling in the Tier 2 process. I just would like to acknowledge Angel Dean for her work on this, basically just setting the groundwork for the I-66 corridor and helping us to complete this process. Now, moving on to Tier 2, over the last 7 months or so, we put together a technical team made up of VDOT, DRPT, the P3 office, Fairfax County, Prince William County, and our federal partners, and we came up with some broad assumptions related to the Tier 2 process and what we wanted to see. I think the most important thing is that we wanted to make sure that we maintain the current number of regular lanes during rush hour, recognizing that we wanted to create a multimodal corridor. We also wanted to look at a rapid bus service as a part of the solution for I-66 as well. Recognizing that of those 10 concepts, we did have four non-capacity improvement projects which could actually move independently or before, or could be incorporated into a larger project. One of the key elements is not to preclude, although we may move forward or may suggest moving forward with some elements of those of the concepts that we have, we should not preclude other future realistic possibilities for the corridor that may happen in the future. And I guess the other key element was to make sure that whatever we came up with was something that we could actually feasibly construct. One of the things that most folks in Northern Virginia know, that 66 has been studied many times over the years, and therefore we wanted to come up with a project that could be implemented. So I just want to take a few minutes.
One comment here I want the board to note. If you look at the fourth bullet where it says preclude other concepts, including the consideration of the metro extension in the right-of-way. Right-of-way is going to be a key factor. We are very constrained the closer we get towards the beltway in terms of the right-of-way. One of the things, we're going to have a meeting not too long from now in Northern Virginia in the next, Carol, you know when that is? Right after the first of the year. Yeah, we're going to take a tour of this, of 66. So I want you to see, because there are some significant issues with right-of-way in terms of overhead bridges and different things as we get in. But I think it's key that we are going to not preclude anything in the future. So I just wanted you to pick that out. That's really important for the success of this project.
Thank you. So this is the current lane configuration. I'll just walk you through this very quickly. If you look at AM Peak is the top figure. So therefore, you're coming in from Route 15 On 66, you have three regular or general purpose lanes and HOV 2 that proceeds until you get to Route 50. At Route 50, there's a change where we still have the HOV 2, but now we're using the shoulder as an arrow lane in order to still provide three general purpose lanes going in into the city. And also, you do have Metro kicking out for Metro. In the AM peak going westbound, you notice that the arrow lanes are marked out, so they're not in use, so the only thing you have is the three general purpose lanes, and then as you move past Route 50, you have four lanes that's open to traffic. The figure below is the PM peak, so we're going out west, coming out of the district. You have the arrow lanes again, which creates three general purpose lanes, and then you also have the HOV 2. Until you get to Route 50, then you still have that similar configuration with the HOV 2 and then three general purpose lanes. In the peak going east, you basically have four coming in from 15 and then dropping back down to three once you get to Route 50 because the shoulder lanes are not in use at that point. The other interesting point that is not on this slide is that most people think that all traffic will continue into the district and into Arlington on 66 inside the Beltway. But actually, we did a traffic study, and we're actually updating that. There is a split at the Beltway where you have 43% going in, continuing on 66. You have 39% going up towards Tyson's, and then another 18 going south on the Beltway. So everything isn't going into the core, isn't going into D.C. So here's where we are.
Do we, in the updated study, we're going to look at how many people are going, that 18% are going south on the Beltway in order to get to 395 because they can't use 66 because they're not two people in a car?
We will be doing an origin destination study. I'm not sure whether we will get down to that level to really look at the 395 corridor, but that's something that definitely we can consider.
I'm just trying to figure out. Initially, when I looked at this presentation, mm-hmm. I was like, well, why are we going to lie to 66 when we're going to get to 66 inside Beltway and can't use it?
Well, that
because it's, and so, but this these numbers make it make sense because there's so many people going to Tyson's now. And we knew that from 95 as well, right? We know that a lot of people from 95 are going to Tyson's too. So that helps me make more sense.
But you made a good point, and I was going to make that comment after we go to the presentations. How we deal with inside the Beltway after working with it is something that because you're right, if you can't spin off, you run right up into it, and then you are stopped. So we're looking at some alternatives, not as a part of this particular study, but in along with it.
It would just make sense to
tie the
turn. Yeah. Mr. Crowley, just as another point for going south, you also dissect 66 outside of Fairfax City with the Fairfax County Parkway. So if you were going to work in Fort Belvoir in that area, yeah, you would get off 66 and go south and the Parkway field as opposed to coming all the way into the Beltway.
Exactly. Yes.
But exactly what you said is what I did. We were up there Monday. And that's exactly what we did. We took 66 and then we spun around to 395 because, 60 couldn't get there.
Okay. So here's what we're proposing for the Tier 2 study. We will be looking at two express lanes, converting the existing HOV 2 lane, and then adding an additional lane to create two express lanes. Of course, HOV 3 converting to HOV 2 to HOV 3, which means that HOV 3 and buses would ride free. And then the non-HOV would be tolled with congestion-based pricing. Also, we will maintain 3 regular lanes at all times for folks who just don't want to pay the toll. And another feature that we will incorporate in the overall design to deal with some of the safety issues is just to make sure that we have ramp-to-ramp connections with the auxiliary lanes, and that will also help the main line of traffic as well. One of the things that Director Mitchell has helped us with as well is to create a rapid bus service for I-66, and not just looking at an express bus system, but really a robust high-frequency system on 66 where we can actually get more people out of their cars and onto buses by providing that service. So I'm going to pause to see whether you have any questions just regarding what we're proposing.
And just to follow up very quickly on the bus service, this is actually, not to steal your thunder from the next slide, but what's being recommended is actually the result of quite a bit of study that's occurred over several years with the stakeholders up there. It recognizes that there's significant core capacity issues on Metro right now, so we're not assuming it would just feed into the end of the Metro line, but would be able to provide service to places like Tyson's Corner or down south into under the 395 corridor, things like that, to serve some of the destinations that aren't necessarily on the Orange Line as well. So it's, I guess you'll talk a little bit about more of, you know, some of those components, but it'll be examined during the EIS. And we see this as being a really important part of moving as many people through the corridor, not just vehicles, because there's so much demand there. We need to be able to do that.
Okay, right. That leads directly into the next slide.
Oh,
sure, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to alert my fellow board members to the fact that in Northern Virginia, there's certainly, we've had our share of controversial transportation projects. If there's one road in all of Northern Virginia that everyone agrees to, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, or if you're conservative, liberal, environmentalist, developer, it's 66 has to be fixed. So set that in your mind. It is the number one priority in our area for those of us who have to live with it every day. And a lot of people around the table have experienced it. It is number one. So have that mindset. Something's got to happen here.
Sorry, Aubrey. I just want to point out one thing. Isn't it kind of a big deal moving from HOV2 to HOV3? Aren't people going to get...
Yes.
I mean, is that fully vetted? Are people on both sides of the aisle okay with that?
No, that's why we're going to do a 17-month public comment. But the answer is, are everybody okay? No. Is it something we should look at? Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
right.
In that. Particularly as we get, as you well know, more hot lanes versus HOV availability.
Well, that's exactly what's my next question. Right. Where does... I know there are some sort of floating in the cloud concepts about doing some hot lanes on 66 in terms of a PPTA.
Right.
And where do those fit in?
That's what the managed lanes, that's what they're speaking of in that regard. In the fact that
HOV zone.
That is a topic that we'll need to talk as a board, not just this road, but
right,
as we go to more managed lanes, where you have the opportunity, is it HOV2 or HOV3 is appropriate? There have studies done, and I got a call on this a couple days ago, where about 9%, I think, of 95 and 395 or 495 hot lanes are for HOV. The rest are still single occupancy, people choosing to pay. So there is this debate as to the amount you're paying for the capacity, allowing people to pay for it, but are we really getting the use of getting people incentivized to use carpool? I will tell you, in Hampton Roads, since we put in the HOV2, the vehicle per person per vehicle has gone down. It's went from like 1.7 to 1.1. I guess it can't get below zero, but
not yet.
Not yet. Not yet. Might, maybe someday it will. So the point, but that is a policy. I think that's not just a fist that we'll need to look at, and I think what'll come up as we go through here as to if you have the ability, are we really as a policy incentivizing people to use carpools?
So for this one, I'm looking at these typical sections where it says express lane. That could be either HOV, or it could be hot lane, or it could be...
Yeah, probably is going to be some type of tolling managed lane.
Okay,
yes,
sorry.
That's
okay.
Correct, yes. I think, to be honest with you, Mr. Traylon, and I know Mr. Coolman is going to come up and talk about this, I think to make this a reality, we're going to have an additional revenue source in that. So,
one other point that I would add to that is the conversion of HOV2 to HOV3, although many people may not realize this, but in our regional constraint long-range plan, it's scheduled to go to HOV3 regardless whether we do any improvements to this particular project or not. So it is planned for that. All right, as Director Mitchell has indicated, DRPT actually led a study in 2009 that looked at 66 from a transit component as well as transportation demand management, and in cooperation with all of the localities and the transit providers in that particular area. We will use that study as a springboard moving into the Tier 2 process, and that will be headed or led by DRPT staff as well, and we just want to thank Director Mitchell as well as Amy Inman for their assistance in this. But what we would be doing is looking at the addition of park and ride lots, looking at those locations, and then providing direct access from those park and ride lots to the express lanes. Slightly different than a true BRT where you have a set-aside right-of-way, this is rapid bus service where you're basically incorporating the service into the express lanes. And then looking at a parallel service would provide a parallel service to the metro station, to the metro system as well. So here we are. This is what the typical section will look like. The top section, basically you have, starting to the outside, you have a full shoulder, three regular lanes. Then you have a separated facility with the express lanes, HOV lanes. And then for this particular typical section at the top, we're looking at preserving 34 and a half feet for future center transit with a shoulder to the inside. And then on the opposite side, you have the same configuration. Now, the difference between what we have now on I-66, the HOV2 lane is not barrier separated by anything except for a striped line. So this will actually help to facilitate a separate facility. The typical section below basically takes out the 34 and a half feet for center transit and basically provides a narrower footprint for the I-66 corridor. So this is what we propose to advance into the Tier 2 study process. So the overall benefits of this particular project, as we've stated before, is just providing travel choices. Reducing the congestion along I-66. Also, designing a more seamless network of transit HOV as well as express lanes throughout the region in order to access places like Tyson's. Creating a robust express transit system. Also, the predictability or reliability of the express lanes to have a consistent travel. And then just promoting the connectivity throughout the region to a lot of the major destinations that we have. With the magnitude and the elements of this particular project, we do feel it would be a good candidate for an innovative project delivery method.
Just make one comment there. I was just going to reiterate what Mr. Brzezinski said. I think this project benefits sort of undersells. I mean, what is needed up there? I mean, it is certainly stopping commerce. You have the issue with Dulles Airport. You're gonna, we don't really get into that, but they've had a significant decline in domestic travel at the airport. Now, there's some other reasons, but getting to this, getting this opened up, getting to is a key component. I think it's fair to say that it's not only probably the number one rural of Virginia, it's probably the number one in the state in terms of what we're, I think over the next, we need to address or try to address. So just throw that out there. It is a significant right now barrier to economic development in Northern Virginia and leading out to points west into further out into Virginia and elsewhere. So I just wanted to, like I say, I think these are good benefits, but I don't think it sort of understates. It's a real problem we've got to deal with.
Well, thank you. All right, next, as equally as important as setting the scope is basically providing the right public outreach and agency coordination. And we are in the process of really developing a robust outreach plan. We are planning on using all the existing social media and all of those things to get our message out there. But one of the supervisors, Supervisor Smith, advised us that don't discount sitting down at the kitchen table. Don't discount sitting down with the community leaders. And we are going to incorporate that in our overall plan as well. Mr. Secretary, you started the process with meeting with the chairs of both Prince William and Fairfax to get their buy-in. And we would just like to thank you and the Commissioner for setting the tone for us and making sure that we take the time up front to really do outreach correctly. During that time, we've had some meetings with the public, which were not really well attended. So we do need to work on that more. Since that time, we've actually held at least 15 briefings with elected officials, Gerald Conley, Delegate Russ, Delegate Lemunyan, to name a few, just to brief them individually on I-66 and this particular proposal that we're moving forward. In those discussions, we did not hear anyone say, this is a bad idea, you shouldn't do anything on 66. There were a lot of good suggestions that we gained from them regarding public outreach and just making sure that we get input and buy-in from the public was one of the key messages that we heard. One of the other things that we're doing is putting together a technical advisory group that will consist of all of the regulatory agencies as well as the localities. We probably have a list of maybe 30 people so far. One of the things that we've done is we've invited EPA, the Corps, Fish and Wildlife, to actually be a part of that technical work group. We've already started some outreach with them as well and other regulatory agencies just to make sure that we are as inclusive as possible with this particular project. So with that, I would now like to turn it over to Mr. Coulomb.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board.
Good morning.
The public-private partnership process for the I-66 corridor improvements began with high-level and detail-level screenings. The high-level screening evaluated the project concept and determined that procurement via a public-private partnership did offer additional efficiencies that otherwise could not be achieved through a traditional procurement, such as accelerating the project development delivery, adding value through transferring risks to private sector partners, and an ability to raise private capital to assist in project finance. The commissioner of VDOT concurred and moved that high-level screening to a detail-level screening. The detail-level screening then also validated that a public-private partnership on 66 was both desirable and feasible. So what does that mean? Well, desirability includes measuring the public need, the public benefits, the economic development potential, stakeholder support, market demand, and legislative considerations. Feasibility includes technical feasibility, the interface with the existing system, financial feasibility, legal and legislative feasibility, project risks, and life cycle management. So the PPTA steering committee that exists at the time in 2013 validated those findings and assigned a goal to try to procure the project within 2 years. PPTA committee also recommended, and we put out a request for information to the private sector that solicited information from them, and that confirmed a high level of private sector interest in the project, also financial market interest in the project, and suggested that best practices and innovative approaches could really deliver best value through competition in this way. Let me go back one. Yeah, there we go. That's the one we should talk about. So our status at the moment, there's several important conclusions we have. Due to the level of complexity of the project and the opportunity to create value through an innovative project delivery approach, the private sector is interested in a delivery method that includes design, construction, finance, operation, and maintenance of the project. Second, we found that minimizing uncertainty is a key element in achieving the best value in a P3 project of this kind. Uncertainty actually reduces competition and adds costs that eventually add to the bill that's presented to the Commonwealth. So we include some studies early in the process to ensure a feasible scope to the project and a realistic procurement schedule. The proposed scope for this project includes toll revenue, which would be used to pay a portion of the project cost. The level of this revenue would indicate how much the private sector may invest in the project in terms of debt and equity. Our early studies suggest that the proposed scope for the project will cost between $2 and $3 billion, depending on the final configuration and the actual project footprint. Toll revenue that we expect from the project would not be sufficient to pay for the full scope of that project, so we expect some Commonwealth funds will be necessary to deliver the benefits and service improvements that we expect. The project is likely to include a number of financing elements, such as reaching out to get a low-cost TIFIA loan from the federal government in order to optimize the financial structure of the project and leverage public dollars, particularly state dollars.
Mr. Coulin, we have a question after Mr. Williams.
When you did the total study, what was the percentage of revenue back to the project?
You know, it was a really rough study at the time, and market conditions certainly changed in a year, which is why we want to do another one. But at the time, it would be the revenue from tolls might cover half the project.
Let me make one point about that, too. The fifth bullet here, and I want to point out to the board, is a major change from our position in previous P3s. I'm not talking about a form change, but previously, before, we were looking for the lowest public subsidy, as you for you on the board of that. This will be looking for the one that provides the best benefit to the public. So we're starting from a different position. One, we have a little more, obviously we have some capital, but two, philosophically, we're starting from the point, I know Mr. Williams and Mr. Brillen are working through some form things we're working on, but we'll be, the Commonwealth will be sitting at the table as saying that we're willing to put our money up, the appropriate amount of risk that we allocate, how it's paid for, that will be as the driving factor in these negotiations, not the lowest public subsidy. If it ends up being the lowest public subsidy, great. I mean, but that's not where we're going to be, this one will be. And I can't, it's going to wait till Doug finished, but we can't overestimate how, emphasize how important it is that we not only work on the P3 process, but we get this negotiated correctly. So I just want to point that out. Yeah, Mr. Malvin.
Will there regional funds participate in the financing?
They're not precluded from participating, and as we develop it, they're not precluded. Not necessarily they don't have to. I mean, that may be one factor that determines the success of the project, but that decision has not been made. But they're not precluded from participating.
I would suggest, Mr. Malvin, that's a possibility. If the localities see additional benefits they want to derive from the project, for example, more a new entry and exit point for a specific community,
Right.
They may be willing to. That certainly happened on the Silver Line, where there were certain purely local concerns about how it would work, and they were willing to put their own money in to make sure those things occurred. So that's our status at the moment. Our next steps, we'll advance these under our PPTA implementation guidelines that focus on enhancing competition and ensuring transparency in the process. It starts very soon with a risk workshop on July 29th, which will identify and discuss major project risks with key stakeholders and look to develop a risk management plan that achieves best value for the Commonwealth through transferring risk to the private sector and or using mitigation strategies. So that workshop will include the central office at VDOT, the Northern Virginia office, FHWA, DRPT, as well as our public-private partnership office. We will conduct an affordability analysis to provide decision makers with more detailed and current financial information about the project. We'll calculate the anticipated level of private investment in the form of equity and debt based on the toll revenue projections, estimate the capital costs of the project for different scenarios, and estimate the range of need for public funds. This analysis will help establish the most efficient scope for the project and the level of public investment that's appropriate for the project. And we'll conduct a preliminary value for money analysis to further study risk allocation in a public-private partnership structure as compared to a design-build structure. We will update that value for money analysis as procurement documents are developed and risks are allocated. But the goal is to ensure a P3 model for the delivery that gives the highest value to the Commonwealth compared to other delivery models. If at any time it's determined that a different delivery model, such as a design-build approach, is better, provides better value for the state, then that model may be selected as the preferred delivery method. We'll brief you later this year on the outcomes of those studies I mentioned prior to initiating any procurement. If we decide together to procure it through the PPTA process, we will issue an RFQ, a request for qualification, possibly as early as late this year, and proceed with the 120-day competition period as specified in the Code of Virginia. That would allow us to shortlist teams as early as spring 2015, complete one-on-one meetings with those teams to develop a request for proposal that could be finalized by the end of 2015 or early 2016. All project documents would be available to the public as well as you on a project website. CTB would be briefed at every major milestone, announcement of the shortlisted teams, issuance of the final RFP, selection of a successful offerer, and the financial close, of course. Our goal, again, is to encourage competition and increase transparency as we move forward and see this I-66 project proceeding under guidelines that are improved and that work better and that will be a model for our future public-private partnerships that the Commonwealth may undertake.
Yes, Mr. Cole.
Thank you. A couple of meetings ago, Deputy Secretary Donahue walked us through some of the issues with the old forecasting of traffic conditions, market conditions. We obviously talk about looking at market conditions is going to be obviously a very important step. Do we look to use a different type of analysis than we have in the past?
I think we'll continue to use some of the traditional analysis, but we'll augment it with some of the more modern techniques. What I think we want to try to do in this project is actually generate a range of those traffic estimates that we will give to the teams that are interested. So those teams, which will do their own studies, don't suddenly decide to have better numbers than somebody else and therefore more revenue potential and so forth. So we realize that's a key to this, you know, what that estimate is going to be, and we want to get the responses to our shared estimate, not just an overly optimistic estimate from someone that lets them project a very optimistic financial model for the project. So,
Mr. Mullen.
What determines whether the project
You know, It's several factors, but the main one is whether there's potential to attract private investment. The design build process also can deliver a project more quickly. It also can allow for risk sharing, but the ability to attract private capital is what marks the partnership. It's the unique element.
Mr. Tom.
Guidelines, are they completed or are they still working
process? No, I was going to make a comment to that. That's a work in process that Mr. Farrell and Mr. Williams are working with the P3 office on. But I will say this, is that I don't know what form that may take and what will come out, although I know it will be enhanced. But I will say that this board will not be asked to transfer money until you understand the risk, the business deals, all that's involved in this project. Now, I don't know what that form will be, whether it means close. I don't know. We'll have to work through that process. But I will make the commitment, the CTB will not be asked to move monies on this project without fully understanding the risk, the business terms of the deal. So that, I don't know exactly what that's going to be, but that commitment I will can assure you will happen. On this process, if it's deemed to be a P3, and that.
It's a good question, Allison. I think our scope of our mission is to deliver something by October.
Right.
And I think the vision would be that wherever this process is for this particular project at that time, it would be plugged into that process, and there will be ample. We've already sort of agreed to that. There's going to be certain checkpoints that CTB looks at, so that'll all be part of it. Can I ask you another question?
Yes, Mr. Pro, yes, yeah.
I think Mr. Malvin makes a good point. This is the first big project that we're going to have in a district that's subject to the new transportation revenues district. And I think if we go into it not assuming that they're going to pay any money, they're going to assume they're not going to pay any money. And so it's they're not going to offer, and so there's a little bit of a negotiation that's going to have to take place here. I can't imagine, this is just me talking, not for the board obviously, but that the General Assembly authorized these two new revenue sources, and the biggest project in that region wouldn't be at least somewhat funded by that. So I just throw that out there. That's my own personal
yeah. view. I think others view that in a similar manner, and it really will get down to the project's going to come to fruition or not.
Right.
I mean, so, but you're absolutely right in that regard. I would think, and I don't want to use the term but for, but this is truly going to be a combination. It's really a large project, guys. It's going to be, I won't say how many billions, but it's going to be in that range. It's probably going to take a combination of monies, combination of programs, and therefore I think all that will need to be looked at if this is going to really come to reality, which is the intent that it will be. Mr. Brill, I think that is something that will certainly be discussed and negotiated as we go through the process.
Yeah, I will say this, Mr. Secretary. We expect this to be quite a layered,
right.
A layer of financing options. And there's a lot of things. For example, are the buses for the transit component included in the scope of the project, or is that something the localities would include both regionally as well as their own individual systems? So those will be a part of the discussions going forward, certainly.
Well, I could make a prediction that whatever we come up with, if it relied just totally on state dollars, I would think it'd have a very little chance of getting approved. Because I think it's just going to require private, when we get through this. I mean, that's not prejudging it, but this is a major, major project.
Yeah. I would just point out to the board also that this will be the first project that actually is going forward under a newer, stricter set of guidelines that are much more coherent. The decision points are clear. The way the public and the CTB will be engaged are laid out in a way that they weren't for all the projects that have gone forward to now. those kind of grew project by project. Well, that seemed to work, let's do more of it. That didn't work, let's do less of that. So this is a much more formal process. It's very highly organized, and there's no steps that are going to be skipped here. So I want to assure you about that. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the presentation. Thank you. If we reach out to the community, are we documenting the telework activities among employees, flexing on them? To me, it's a congestion management tool. It's not a thing to see yet, but I know more and more people are working from home, more and more people have flex times with their work. So is this something we should engage for this example?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's clearly a key factor that goes into the analysis, like how is the facility likely to be used in the future, and you and I have talked about this before. What's the nature of work then 20 years from now? Why would people go to an office building anyway? That sort of thing certainly is underway. So that'll be captured indirectly, I think, in the analytical process. I would expect. Yes.
Is this for the approved form for these new guidelines?
It will be, I don't know if it's the board. Well, you'll certainly be informed. I'm not exactly sure if the CTB is the one that actually signs off. We'll get your approval. I don't know that that is actually the formal sign off. I suspect we'll have some legislators that will offer some bills this year that we'll have to consider. In that, as they are written now, the CTB is not the formal sign. Doesn't mean that you won't approve, but as they're written now, that is not the deal. Yes, Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, might we not do that in the resolution then?
Yes, we could do that. We support them, or you don't, that in regard. So that's what I'm saying. Yes.
Kind of what we've been talking about.
Right. Yeah. I mean, certainly want your approval. Yeah.
It would certainly be a more formal process,
right,
than it has been in the past.
That's correct.
And I think to Dixon's point, it's a good point.
Well, let's put it this way. We can't, unless you allocate money, the project can't go forward. That hasn't changed.
No.
But what will change is the information that you have to make. We have to make those decisions.
And one of the things we have to do in this process is allocate money to proceed.
Certainly.
Because it takes a significant amount of resources from VDOT,
right,
to evaluate these things. And so there's a checkpoint there, and there'll be another checkpoint before we sign off on the deal.
Right.
Just one more slide.
Yes, ma'am.
As far as next steps, first of all, thank you, Mr. Koulame, and as well as thank your staff. Morteza Farajan has been working with us and Dusty Holcomb. We have assembled an excellent team to get this done, both internal to the agencies involved as well as our private partners and consultants led by Susan Shaw. And we are proceeding on the environmental process with traffic data as well as survey and some of those key elements of the project. We will have a breakfast kickoff meeting tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock for the elected officials as well as the media. So far we have 60 people signed up to attend that. Mr. Secretary, you were speaking at that event as well as the Commissioner and Director Mitchell and Mr. Koulame as well. We will continue to coordinate with all of the agencies as we go through this process. This will be a very inclusive process. Our target schedule is up there for everyone to see. The formal request that this board will be asked to select an alternative will be in 2015 with anticipation of completing the NEPA process by the end of 2015 and construction projected to start in 2017. We know that that's an aggressive schedule, but we will be very deliberate in our approach and our process as we move forward with this project. So thank you for your time and your attention.
Mr. Casper.
The Secretary spoke to the need to preserve, if at all possible, the right of way for the Metro. Will the Tier 2 look at the total footprint requirement for a Metro extension, including stations, access, parking areas, or just the right of way within the center?
Just the right-of-way within the center median, in order for us to basically get into the dimensions regarding the stations, it will take us into truly evaluating Metro as an option. As a part of that, we will have some elements where we identify some areas where, even in Fairfax's county's comprehensive plan, they have a bubble. So we will basically use that information of possible station locations. They already have a station in their comprehensive plan for Stringfellow, one at Monument and one at 28.
So that will be,
those things will be in court.
Exactly. How could that be added to the process? What would that require?
We would have to work with Director Mitchell to basically look at whether we truly incorporate that as an option moving forward. Under the Tier 1 process, it actually was a separate. It gave us the opportunity to handle the transit component on a separate track, recognizing that FTA would have to be involved in that process compared with our process where we would work directly with FHWA. So that would actually mean just coordinating differently.
Respond to that.
Yeah, and I've had the opportunity to meet with WMATA about this, and I should say this is extremely important to Fairfax County as well. This having Metrorail in that corridor is part of their long-range plan and part of their comprehensive plan, and they've made it very clear as well that it's very important to them to preserve the ability to do Metrorail in the future. However, because of the constrained right-of-way, there's going to be a very real trade-off between, frankly, taking people's homes and preserving that right-of-way. That's going to require some really creative thinking. We've met with Metro about this. They've also pledged to offer their creative thinking in that as well, to look at ways where we can preserve the capacity there, but also try to minimize impacts. And there may be some ways to, maybe you don't need the whole 35 feet, maybe you can stack the tubes or something like that, that I think will be part of the design process. But it's something that the team's very committed to doing, is to making sure that it is preserved, but it's going to be a very, very tight squeeze with some real trade-offs in the short term as well. But we all recognize that there's certainly significant demand in that corridor to justify Metrorail in the long term, should the region decide to move forward with that. But right now, the funding doesn't exist, and frankly, we've got much bigger issues on core capacity within the Metrorail system to deal with before we can even think of looking at more extensions in that corridor for the next, probably decades.
Let me wrap this up with one comment. Thank you, Renee. And Mr. Coulomb, thank you, Doug. This is a top priority for Governor McCullough, but he would like us to move forward with all prudent haste. I'm going to use the word prudent haste. It's his last time he talked with you. He said, we are not a rubber stamp. Meant that. We want to get this project going. We want to move efficiently, but not recklessly. So we will be moving forward, but with all the safeguards and prudence. I just want to make sure that we want to get this going. It's a very important to our Commonwealth, Northern Virginia region. We're going to be smart and efficient about it as we go through it. So, okay, we have. Let's see if I can get to that. Who's up next here? Mr. Lentz, Route 29, another non-confrontational project. Good morning, Mr. Lynch. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm fine, sir. Secretary Lane, Commissioner Kirkpatrick, Director Mitchell, as well as members of the CTB board. Today I'm here just to provide an update on the status on the Route 29 projects that were part of the initial panel recommendations for the 29 corridor and that were funded as part of this year's six-year improvement plan update. Just to orient you a little bit with the projects in the overall program and in the corridor, essentially they're in northern Charlottesville, southern Albemarle County area along Route 29. The projects include the ramp widening for Route 29 250 interchange, or what we affectionately refer that to as the Best Buy ramp, as well as that project is actually in the city of Alexandria, being administered by VDOT. That one's scheduled for advertisement in December of this year. The improvements also include the railroad grade separation interchange in Albemarle County, along with 29 widening from Polo Grounds Road, that's right at the south fork of the Rivanna River, to Hollymead Town Center, as well as Berkmar Drive Extended, which parallels Route 29 on the north side, crossing the Rivanna River. And then the Hillsdale Drive extension on the east side, on the north side, in the northern part of Charlottesville. It's being managed by the city. We're also incorporating the adaptive signal technology in the corridor that'll help with more efficient movement of traffic, not only on the 29 corridor, but on the cross streets as well. We also have the preliminary engineering for the hydraulic road interchange, which will include the Hillsdale South extension in that, as well as the 29-250 interchange. So the package itself is divided into projects in terms of where we received additional funding to complete projects in the program with the update. So the four projects that were included, additional funding included the Best Buy Ramp, the Hillsdale Drive extension, at the 29 widening, and the adaptive signal project. In addition, the update of the six-year improvement plan includes full funding for the Hillsdale Drive South extension, as well as the hydraulic road grade separation, preliminary engineering phase, Berkmar Drive extended, and the Route 29 Rio Road grade separation interchange. Those are all fully funded. Full funding was also provided for the second train set from Lynchburg to D.C. These recommendations that came out of the initial panel meeting were endorsed by the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors, the City of Charlottesville Council, as well as the Charlottesville Area MPO. As far as, you know, we're going to utilize multiple delivery methods to implement these package of improvements, including design build. As I mentioned, the Best Buy ramp will be advertised as design bid build in December, with the project scheduled to be completed by mid-2016. Hillsdale Drive Extended will continue to be managed by the City of Charlottesville, with a design build delivery method also. In addition, the adaptive signal project will be implemented using an existing operations contract. Three of the major projects, including the 29 widening, the railroad interchange, and the Berkmar Drive extended, will be included in a single request for qualifications, a request for proposal as a design build delivery. The advantage of this approach really is so we can coordinate those projects under one major contract to gain some efficiencies, as well as to expedite the delivery of the project. We're also looking at incentives for different types of accomplishments in terms of early delivery and efficiency of maintenance of traffic and phasing of the project to try to minimize impacts on traffic during construction.
And I'm going to emphasize that point, that the actual bid itself will be limit the amount of hours, limit the traffic congestion overall, so we don't have all the projects going on. In fact, I was talking yesterday, even maybe most of this will be done at night, depending on
right. What
area it's in. So a major component of this will be coordinating so there's the least impact on the business and other communities in Charlottesville.
Which of the projects will be included in a single?
It'll be the Route 29 widening, the Rio Road interchange, and then the Berkmar Drive extension.
It's changed a couple times since we first talked about it.
Yeah, we're trying to get the best efficiencies, and Charlottesville was wanting to do some of the management of it and what have you. So, and that part of that, not only John's group, but working with the panel advisory, trying to address those issues is going through. Yes.
Yeah, the one project that they were talking about also including initially was the Hillsdale Drive extension. In talking with the city, they have some specific development issues as well as plans for that, that it really didn't come across as conducive to design build because they really didn't have a lot of flexibility in what they could do. So we, you know, we agreed that it probably be better to go design bid build and they maintain control over it. You know, project team members, we're going to manage this project out of our Charlottesville residency. We've hired a program director that will also be located in Charlottesville, Dave Covington, as well as we moved our communications manager from our Culpeper District office down to Charlottesville as of this week, so we can really concentrate on keeping the public and businesses informed on the ongoing activities. The local presence, I think, is really key to give those. One of the issues that came out of the first panel meeting was, you know, keeping the businesses informed of what's going on. They realize that there's going to be impacts, but just if they know, one of the business representatives said, you know, if I know when you're going to have a major lane closure, you know, I can have a sale that week to still try to get people in. So that's the dialogue that we want to continue to have with those groups. So we have formed a second advisory panel for the implementation projects, and that will be headed by former Commissioner Philip Chouquette. And we have representation both along businesses, elected officials, local governments, as well as the environmental community. There's two representatives from Albemarle County, two from the city of Charlottesville. We have six business representatives, as well as a representative from the Southern Environmental Law Center. We anticipate construction to begin in the summer of 2015 with a completion of all the projects by late 2017. And as I noted, we look to try to incentivize to complete that program earlier if possible. So just a quick glimpse of some of the milestones that we've achieved so far since we've last talked. We held our first advisory panel meeting last Thursday, July 10th. The panel makeup is a little bit different in terms of the initial panel, emphasizing more on the business community within the corridor. So the initial meeting was really more of a get them up to speed on the program and the projects. Set the goals and the responsibilities of the panel, as well as what they considered to be success factors during the program. And some of those success factors was maintaining local traffic to the levels that they are now. And again, that was primarily from a business standpoint of making sure we don't drive folks away from the corridor. And in conjunction with that, maintaining that tax revenue that they have, because that's a significant portion of Albemarle County's tax base of the businesses in that corridor, and maintaining current traffic lanes as well as access points during construction, and develop adequate risk management practices and avoid consequences. And again, that was in conjunction with some of those discussions about communications and keep them informed so they know what actions they need to take during construction. So, the bottom line with that, we really need to work with both the business community, the local elected officials, and others to make sure this project's a success, implementing some of those strategies in terms of limitations on operations, as well as a good, strong communication plan to keep everybody informed moving forward. So the panel is going to continue to meet every 2 weeks, initially at least through the procurement process, which is what will take place pretty much through the end of the year. So the request for qualifications will be issued to industry next week on July 24th, with the request for proposals of shortlisted firms, basically the firms that meet the qualification requirements, in October of 2014. And we anticipate the design build award contract in February 2015. And followed on that will be the design development, public involvement process and construction next spring and summer. We'll continue our outreach program, you know, throughout the entire process, working to advance formal public hearings as quickly as we develop information to present, and we anticipate project completion in late 2017. And just a note, and you know, incentives for early completion, as I mentioned, will be included in that contract. You know, from the time the CTB approved the 6-year improvement plan in June, we really have hit the ground running with our management team, as well as to begin the implementation of the program. We've engaged consultant firms to support our development of the RFQ and the RFP. In addition, last week, field survey actually started, so we're physically out in the field with our field survey crews. We're developing preliminary plans and concepts that will be utilized during the procurement process and in our public involvement. And we started our geotechnical investigations as well as environmental field work. We've also met with the Army Corps of Engineers and plan a follow-up meeting in the next week or so. And we've coordinated with Federal Highway in terms of the NEPA requirements for all the new projects. The ongoing projects that we had in the program that are now fully funded, we're also working to implement those, the Best Buy Ramp, the Hillsdale Extension, and the Adaptive Signal projects, and the other projects that are included in the design build program. So public and business outreach, as well as the advisory panel meetings, will continue throughout the program. Our next panel meeting coincides with the release of the RFQ, which is next Thursday, and that'll continue until we release the RFP meeting every 2 weeks with the panel. So, Mr. Secretary, that concludes my update, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you or the board may have.
Mr. Franklin? Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I want to preface my questions with the comment that understanding, as I do, when a body's made a decision and not to throw yourself in front of the train, it's usually a good idea. So, I mean, I want to make sure I understand what the resolution we're going to be voting on next time, in the next session is. It's my understanding the decision's been made to go with this plan.
That's correct.
That what we're doing now is cleaning up past business.
That's correct.
And I'm going to vote for it based on that understanding, that the decision's been made and we're moving forward.
That's correct.
But I also want to understand what that's going to do in terms of what we're going to do with the right-of-way. Because this is going to go forward, but I think it would be imprudent to get rid of that right-of-way until we are certain that this is going to proceed. And I don't know if that's where we are or not.
That is the plan where we are taking, rescinding the record of decision because we can't build the road. We don't have it from the feds. That's what the resolution does. Commissioner Kilpatrick and I have had lots of discussions. He's now the right-of-way division is up there cleaning up the properties, getting them ready if we decide in the future to do anything. But we will not make that decision until we determine there's no alternative uses and that this is definitely proceeding as we all projected.
Now, the second thing I want to... How much money have we paid Skanska Branch on this contract that's going to be... We're not going to be able to recoup?
John, approximately how...
It's approximately $2.5 million.
Yeah.
$2.5 to $3 million in that range.
And largely that was engineering work that was initiated. They had a limited notice to proceed because the reevaluation of the environmental document had not been completed, so they had done a very limited amount of work. Their total project contract value was
about $140 million.
That seems reasonable to me. I want to make sure we understand the decision is not without cost.
It is.
The second is that at least we haven't paid a lot of ramp up costs like other projects.
That is correct. This was a design bill with a second notice to proceed,
right.
And We are not in that position.
Now, having said all that, let me ask you about the project, the phasing of it. Is the phasing of the project to do Hillsdale and Berkmar first?
I'll have to let Mr. Lynch
What
it all at one time, right?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of we're issuing the projects all at one time, and the in terms of the construction, there's going to be requirements in there for limitations of operations as well as you know, congestion requirements, and one of the evaluation criteria is going to be efficiency of their maintenance of traffic plan, their traffic management plan. So, for example, one of them could come in and say, I am going to be able to get Berkmar and Hillsdale. I get Berkmar and 29 widening done before the 29 Ryer Road interchange, which may be a big plus, but it may not get them the early completion incentive. But there will be controls in there so that they can't go, you know, if you want to, you know, just go everywhere and impact traffic, there'll be checks and balances in the contract to avoid
one
that.
One more question on slide 2, which is the map, if they can put that up there. My understanding, Hillsdale is part of this, is it not, or am I wrong about that?
Well, it was part of, the reason that it's on that map, it was part of the funding package. When it was one of the projects that was partially funded prior to the update to the SYIP, and it's now fully funded, and it'll be executed by the city in conjunction.
But that's a separate situation.
Right.
Yes, that was ongoing. And let me make, I'll let Mr. Commissioner Kilpatrick make a comment about, look, the quickest way to get things are let's get the things built. That's right. The leap. But having said that, there's a trade-off, and we had this downtown Midtown tunnel, others maintaining the least amount of disruption to the community, and so that will be an part. It may not lead to the absolute lowest price for these for this contract, and that's what we'll have. You know, working with the community and the outreach, the trade-offs for that.
And I understand that, and yeah. I think that one of the consequences of the decision is it's going to be more impact on businesses.
That's right. So we need to make sure we minimize that.
But let me ask one last question. That green mark on hydraulic, that's not part of this, is it?
Well, there was $10 million that was funded for the preliminary engineering for that. And again, this was a snapshot of all the funded projects.
That's all. Thanks.
Did you want to make a comment? I'm going to miss the talk after that.
Yes. Regarding Hillsdale, John, I want to make sure folks are clear. A portion of Hillsdale is actually in Albemarle County, and a portion is within the city limits. Is that correct?
No, it's all in
the city. Okay, so it's all within the city. So that entire project now will be developed by the city of Charlottesville. One of the other points about this balance of, you've seen an aggressive schedule in terms of delivering the project. This is an opportunity, frankly, for construction companies and engineering companies to use to look at different scenarios, different techniques to accelerate construction. As you saw in the presentation, incentivizing early, two things are going on. One is limiting disruption, but the other is incentivizing rapid construction techniques. There are a number of ways that they can do that, and by using the design build delivery method, you gain the advantage of innovation versus us making strictly prescribing the sequence and the techniques that are used. So we see some great opportunities here, and incentivizing in terms of accelerated construction techniques, we found brings out the very best in some of our construction and engineering companies.
Mr. Tompkins, I'll come back to Mr. Williams.
Thank you. Dr. Mitchell, what is the time frame for the second train?
We don't have a firm timetable at this point. We do need to do some additional work to scope out the potential improvements, and it includes potential improvements both in the Norfolk Southern corridor that's out there, as well as actually in the 95 corridor. We're working on that right now. We will need to also meet with CSX and Norfolk Southern to negotiate some potential improvements that will be needed to free up access at that point. We don't have a firm timetable at this point, except that we're starting that process right now. There's a number of moving parts.
And so I'm going to encourage us to get a firm timetable,
yes.
And I'll be happy to meet with you. I'd like to be part of the with Norfolk
Absolutely.
Southern and CSX, because it's the Norfolk. We need to, our whole
number
of things. And so let's get those on the table.
Yep.
Okay. And we'll report back. There's Mr. Williams, and I'll come back. He was next.
Mr. Lynch, is this design build going to include the contractors assuming the risk of the utility relocations?
Typically, that's yes.
You know, I know we're a policy board, but as a broader discussion, and I've been looking at this for 20 years, all the years I've been involved in it, and VDOT's doing it both ways throughout the decades, but the contractor has not one single thread to hold over the head of these huge utility companies that the state of Virginia does have. And I would just, it's tough to me to say we're going to give you some, we're going to incentivize an earlier delivery, but by the way, those utility guys are yours. I mean, some of the clients I've worked with in the past can't even get a phone call back from them. But we do have, you know, we have the SEC, they have a tremendous amount of right-of-way agreements with VDOT, and VDOT has some leverage on it, but the contractor has none.
We've had a meeting with Mr. Kirkpatrick. We agree. That doesn't mean we're out.
I think it's on a project-by-project basis, yeah. But this one begs for it to me. It's going to be a nightmare.
The coordination with utility companies has always been challenging. They have different needs than we have. In some cases, the state does have leverage that a contractor may not have. What we have done on this particular project, the chief engineer is already reaching out to those utility companies early to bring them into this process early. Exactly how that risk transfer will occur regarding the utility relocation, frankly, has not been finalized, but this was recognized early on. It's a high-risk project in terms of utilities. One of the things that the executives of the utility companies, when the secretary and I met with them, was the need for them to be brought in earlier in the process. And this is a clear example of where a higher level of coordination must
start up here.
And when I mean higher level, I mean higher level at the executive level with the utility the major utility companies. Again, we got some pretty positive response from the utility companies when we bring them in early. The exact risk transfer, we're still working out that detail.
But I would think, Mr. Chairman, that it should be a partnership at a minimum.
Absolutely. Right.
And the contractor nor VDOT should take all the risk, but they need the power of the state often to get to that high level person because they don't have direct access to it. There's no motivation for the utility company. But the SEC, every one of them are licensed through them. I mean, there are ways to apply pressure that perhaps we haven't used.
And Mr. Williams, I think your point is right on. It's not, traditionally, it was either us being VDOT or them being the contractor. It is going to be us in terms of us and the contractor working in close cooperation with the utility company. What we also didn't want to do is say, don't do anything until we, the state, moves all the utilities, because that can easily draw a project out and the disruption that occurs with utility relocation for an extended period of time. So there's great advantage in working cooperatively, but we recognize very early on this is a high-risk area and we'll receive special attention.
And sometimes our contractor has a better relationship.
Sometimes.
And think about this. When I was building, it's really the relationship of the guy in the district.
Max.
And in other words, if they have a good relationship, that's what we're trying to identify. But that's right. In other words, a lot of them, you know, it's like a good property manager. You got a good property manager, things move along. You don't, you better get above him pretty quickly. And that stuff. So
who is Mr. Capra? And I'll come out this
one. Secretary, is there any time frame associated with a decision on right-of-way sale?
I think there's two things that are driving that. One is I want to make sure that we are make a right decision with the right-of-way in terms of, I will tell you, some of the things we've sold before we wish we hadn't. So that'll go into this in terms of do we need it or is there alternative uses. But there is a time limit, 20 years, and we're coming up on that. This right-of-way, much of it was bought almost 20 years ago. In that regard, so we are working with Federal Highways to not run up against that to say, well, you must do it in that regard. I think that'll work through. I will just be honest. A big factor is I'm going to make sure that the success of these projects is assured before we start selling right away. And I know that may not fit in well within the technical aspects of what might have to happen, and we may deal with that. deal with that. But in terms of the political realities and what I think is the correct way to proceed, that's what we're going to do. And so we'll work through those. So I would guess that having said that, you're probably looking at anywhere from 90 days, probably the earliest at all, my guess. But you know, it may be 6 months to a year before we're assured that this is the case. Hopefully it won't be that long, but I don't...
Within a reasonable time frame.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly not more than 2 years.
Yeah, no, and that's right. And we're working. We've had contact with some of the surrounding neighbors. There's, in that regard, we're cleaning it up. So we'll be good stewards of it, because it's not only for them, but for the state. So if, when we do decide it, we'll have it in the best shape we can get it in that regard. So... So yeah, I'm not totally driven, or we're not totally driven by the technicalists, let's do the right thing, and we'll go that. The other side of that, I do know there's some people in limbo, and I don't want to keep them in limbo forever, but let's make sure our purposes are served, and then we'll move on. Mr. Wentworth, I'll come back.
I'd like to pick up on a comment the Commissioner made with regard to the certification completion. My question is there ever, or is there a way to measure mitigation of disruption and have any type of incentivization for that? Because in this particular corridor, my guess is disruption is going to be just as much of an issue as early completion would be.
And the answer to that is yes. In terms of the shorter that the project, the less time overall that it takes, less overall disruption to businesses, to the community, to travelers. But there are also disruptions that I'll call reduction in capacity, whether it's 24-hour capacity or peak capacity. You'll hear terms sometimes, things called lane rental and some of those techniques, which basically means that taking a lane, there's a cost of taking a lane, and what does that cost? So there's some things in the world of how accelerated construction where you look at those types of things. It will probably be a combination of measuring disruption and frankly some hard rules that we will install. It may be certain peak periods that we will say you just will not reduce capacity during certain days or certain times of day. I mean, I'll use for us to close lanes down in advance of a UVA football game would be completely intolerable. So that's kind of an example.
What's that piece of hope?
And it hurt me to say that, but we would do, whether it was in Blacksburg or in Charlottesville, reducing lane capacity as people are traveling to a major event would be sort of an example. Also peak AM, PM, peak periods, things like that. So there are some things that we would do in that area.
But let me, look, we have the same situation at the downtown Midtown tunnel. The contractor, the quickest way to do it is to close that tunnel down for a month and do the repairs. No way that can happen. So basically, there was two or three options, and I assume that's what will be the case here, that we work with the locality and say, look, to think there's going to be no disruption, that is not realistic. On the other hand, to work curtails business and economic activity, we should stop that. There'll probably be various alternatives and say, you know, do you want to close nights? Do you want to close weekend? I mean, in other words, what is, and there's a cost to that. That's what I would envision happening here, working with the outreach so that people know what's coming in that regard. But you're right. It's something... We are not looking, quite frankly, the least cost to the Commonwealth would be to shut the roads down and do it all. We obviously are not going to do that. And then, Mr. Williams, do you have Mr. Fraylor?
Well, I don't want to beat the right-of-way issue to death, but I think we might be a little premature assuming this is going to work for through traffic. It might. It's going to be designed to do that. But... You know, I hope it works.
We'll have some hard, those that may not totally be in our hand at the end with the federal highways.
I understand.
But and that's what I was going to say, we'll get there. But at least I think we definitely got to make sure this works and then we'll
going to be your decision.
Yeah.
The Berkmar Drive, is that, have we decided whether that's limited access or not?
It will not be limited access, but it'll fall under the access management standards. So we won't end up in a situation where we've got entrances every 200 feet. It'll be in accordance with that correct.
And that's one thing we're going to, quite frankly, that's the real issue in the area, because they weren't enforced the way they should have been. And so we're going to insist that they are enforced that way. I mean, I think that's one of the things that you'll find that we will be pretty strict on.
Just one last question, Mr. Chairman. We're still going from B to D, though, right? When we talk about how the project's going to work, it was a D and it's going to be a D when it's finished.
You're talking about levels of service.
Yes. So was the bypass.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So was the bypass.
So 29 stayed D even with the bypass.
Yeah, even with the bypass. None of these projects improved, other than. They're the beginning of setting that stage in that. Okay, Mr. Lentz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Dean for 460. They get a little easier as we go along, don't they?
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, Commissioner, Director Mitchell, members of the board. I'm pleased to come to you today and provide you an update on our forward progress with the 460 Corridor Improvement Project. My name is Angel Deem. I work with VDOT's Environmental Division, and I'm managing the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement for 460. So to provide a bit of context, by the end of last year, after an extensive partnering effort between VDOT and the two federal agencies, FHWA and the Corps of Engineers, it was determined that a supplemental EIS would be necessary to look at the impacts of the proposed project and also consider additional alternatives, due in part to the Corps' decision-making that was necessary for permitting. By the end of last year, in December, there was a memorandum of understanding executed between the three agencies that provided a framework for the conduct of the supplemental EIS. I would note that just prior to execution of that MOU and in anticipation of its execution, the three agencies formed a study team in order to expedite delivery of this SEIS, and we began meeting weekly prior to December and have continued to do that through today, and I think that's a large part of the success that we've achieved thus far. Also in December, the two federal agencies, as required, issued notices of intent in the Federal Register, essentially signifying the kickoff of the SEIS and requesting comments on the scope and alternatives for consideration. It also made clear that both agencies would be joint leads on this document. What that means is that both agencies will own the document and use it for their decision-making purposes. Also, as you know, in March, the work was stopped on the contract and permitting activities on the preferred alternative. I would just note that didn't in any way impede the progress of the SEIS, because those activities were occurring in parallel. A quick overview of the SEIS. We've updated the assumptions and the analyses supporting the purpose and need for the project, but as you can see here, they remain virtually unchanged from the needs that were identified with the original location study. As I'm also sure you're aware, there are five build alternatives under consideration, as well as the no build. The way that the study team arrived at that range of alternatives was really through that notice of intent process. So we received lots of feedback from the public and other agencies that the study team reviewed, collaborated, and arrived at the five build alternatives that are under consideration. The resource analyses to support this SEIS is quite extensive. Because of the consideration of new alternatives and the need to ensure all the information was brought to bear for future decision making, we have covered the full range of resource analyses in this SEIS. So this map represents the approximate 750 square mile study area that was identified in the original location study. We've maintained that study area through the conduct of this SEIS, and this graphic shows the five build alternatives together. And then I'm going to get into just describing for you each of those build alternatives. And I've left at your chairs a handout that we're using for some public outreach that also has these maps on it. Alternative one is a four-lane limited access toll facility that runs south of the existing Route 460. It was previously identified as the preferred alternative in the 2008 Record of Decision. We're studying this within a 200-foot design corridor. It has a design speed of 75 miles per hour. It has 9 interchanges, 2 termini interchanges, and 7 intermediate interchanges. This has been referred to previously as CBA-1, if you're familiar with that. Alternative two is a four-lane road that runs along existing 460, so it essentially upgrades the existing road for lane width, median, and shoulders. It also provides bypasses around the town. I would note that between the towns, access is managed as it is today, so entrances for driveways and businesses and intersections. For the bypasses, that typical section matches alternative one, so it's a four-lane limited access roadway around each of the 6 towns. The bypasses on alternative two are being studied as both tolled and non-tolled or untolled. You may note on the graphic that there's both a north and southern bypass of the town of Windsor, and that's just due to some changes in land use north of town. That led the team to decide to also investigate a southern bypass of Windsor. There are no termini interchanges as this runs along the existing route and ties into existing conditions on Route 460 at either end of the corridor. Alternative 3 was also studied in the original EIS. It's a four-lane limited access toll facility that is north of existing 460. Has the same configuration as alternative one, 75 mile per hour design speed. We're studying it within a 260-foot design corridor. Alternative four is largely a new alternative. It is a true improved existing alternative end-to-end. It does not incorporate bypasses around the town. This is the only alternative that actually provides improvements within the town. If you look back to alternative two, we bypass the towns. We do not provide any improvement to existing 460 within the town limits. This alternative provides an end-to-end improvement. Outside of the town, we're studying a approximate 200-foot design corridor with a 60 mile per hour design speed. When we transition into the town, that goes to more of an urban section with curb and gutter and sidewalks, about 100-foot design corridor. Alternative 5, this is an 8-lane road that follows existing 460. This essentially takes the limited access toll facility and co-locates it with the existing 4 lanes of local road or free road. So the limited access facility would be to the interior. The local access roads would be on either side. When you come to the towns, the access roads would transition into town under existing conditions. The limited access facility would then go on the bypass around the town. Okay, so looking ahead, we're currently finalizing all the technical reports that support the supplemental EIS. As I mentioned earlier, we've had great cooperation amongst our study team and with our federal partners. It's allowed us to essentially do a very extensive, robust analysis in about 7 months. The project team is initiating some informational town hall meetings that begin next week. There are actually 5 of those. The purpose of those are to let folks come and ask questions, bring them current, and hopefully prepare them for the upcoming location public hearing where we will solicit comments. The draft SEIS is set to be approved for public availability by late September. That will enable us to kick off the prescribed 45-day comment period. It would allow us to hold the public hearing soon after the document is approved, we hope in early October. At the conclusion of that comment period, which again should be end of October, beginning of November, we will look to the federal agencies to consider the analysis we've conducted over these many months, consider the comments that they've received on the draft document, and make a decision on the preferred alternative looking ahead, or in the Corps' language, the identification of the LEDPA, or least environmentally damaging practicable alternative. So we're asking that they do that by the end of the year. We're certainly trying to position things such that they can make that decision by the end of the year. We would then brief this board on the outcome of the draft supplemental, the metrics included, as well as a summary of the comments received and the decision by these federal agencies, and look to the board to either affirm or change the location decision for this project. We would then kick off the final SEIS in 2015. Don't have a schedule for that because obviously it's very dependent on the alternative that's identified. The final supplemental would address comments received on the draft. It would provide more detailed analysis on the preferred as appropriate. We would also at that time reinitiate the permit activities so that the culmination of this project would be a record of decision. That record of decision by Federal Highway will be a location decision. The record of decision by the Corps of Engineers would be their permit decision. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Mr. President. So on your outreach program, have all the state senators and members of the House of Delegates, as well as all local officials affected by the corridor, been notified that this is what's going on, and so it's totally transparent?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
The project office has a public involvement team that's been doing that throughout the development of this project, and will continue to.
Thank you.
So we will know at the end of the year tentatively what alignment will revolve in the LEPTA.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really will be the next step for this board, as well as bringing back to you once we know what we're building, if we're building it based on the financial plan. Mr. Fraylin.
I'm a little confused. It's kind of a normal state for me, but where were we before? Didn't we have a Federal Highways approval?
We had a Federal Highway record of decision.
Right.
We did not have a permit from the Army Corps.
I understand that. But why are we doing a supplemental environmental impact?
I'll let Charlie.
When we've already got...
Because they rescinded it, so I'll let Charlie go into that.
So there are two... you have the federal action... That was the Federal Highway Administration issued a record of decision on what was called, call it CBA-1, which is the first alternative of the five, as you see.
The red one on this.
That's correct. They issued a record of decision. There's a separate federal action required by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in issuing a permit. The Corps of Engineers, in order for them to issue a permit, there's a number of things they have to do. And one of them is the sufficiency of the environmental document. So from the Corps of Engineers perspective, in order for them to issue a permit, the original document was not sufficient for them to render a permit decision. So that is the supplemental environmental impact study that is ongoing now is to do, if Ray basically brings the Federal Highway decision and the Army Corps of Engineers decision together, so that a single decision can be made as to what is a permittable facility that meets the purpose and need.
Okay, so we've got two pieces of the executive branch of the federal government, and one can basically veto the other and say, we know you've got a record decision over here, and you thought the environmental impact statement was okay, but we don't think it's sufficient for us to be able to make our permit decision, so go back and do it again.
That is unusual, but correct. Yes. I mean, I think that's the best way to put it in that. Unusual, but correct.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And that's it. Mr. Wentworth.
Is alternative one still a viable alternative?
Yeah, it's viable, but I don't... let's be realistic. If it were really, I guess the answer is yes, it's viable. But the Corps
did not believe it was the most viable, the most least impactful, and that's where we're going through this. There is a potential that it could be determined as least impactful.
And if I could just add to that, Mr.
Yes,
Secretary, all five alternatives are considered to meet the purpose and need of the project, perhaps to varying degrees. But so with that in mind, all five of those alternatives are on equal footing under equal consideration for selection as the preferred.
I know that the Army Corps is worried about wetlands, and they should be. But do they also take into calculation, for example, if we built alternative 2, we're going and building bypasses around towns and taking a lot of business property, a lot of existing property, a lot of economic disruption to these communities that they won't suffer if we build the other one. Is that part of their consideration too, or are they just strictly looking at wetlands?
I'll let Angel respond, although I would tell you there's disagreement as to whether the town, I'm saying whether some like it, some didn't, but Angel, you could respond.
The core selection of preferred, or that acronym, least environmentally damaging practicable alternative, means that the Corps does take into consideration issues of practicability, that's cost, that's relocations and other community disruption, so they do weigh that along with the wetland stream impacts.
Your question, Ms. Cronin, you tie those two questions together, the federal highways did take the VDOT's position that this was the least impactful. But when it was obvious, or not obvious, when it became apparent that they were no permit, they, working with VDOT, decided to rescind that designation, record of decision. And now all three parties are working together in that. So whatever comes out, all three agree on in that regard. So that's really how we got here. Whether it was, there's a lot of people thinking what happened and what have you. Whether it was federal overreach, whether it was us not understanding, it was risk in the project that we did not adequately protect ourselves on. I think that's the best way to put it there. So we've gone back. I think probably this will be a process that we will use going forward, while unusual, it can happen. And having said that, it's 55 miles. It's the largest impact of wetlands since the Clean Water Act. So, you can have different opinions, but we think this approach is the best. We are now working together with them, and Angel's done a fantastic job. She's leading this team, the work we've done in 7 months is really been, and a lot of that has to do because the Corps, Colonel Olson, has given the commitment and he's pushed his people. So it looks like that is a model that we will replicate in the future.
Mr. Secretary, hopefully with a little additional time frame in the future. But yes, we've accomplished quite a lot in 7 months due to the coordination.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, well, Secretary, I understand that when we initially, I think it was our first meeting, the vote was taking place, so I didn't have a lot of back history. But one of the big reasons was the sense of urgency coming from the Port Authority, from the government, the military. We still going to be able to work within the time frames.
What was that again?
It was a sense of urgency that was given, for the project from, the Navy, Port Authority.
The
issue that was at that time.
Having additional capacity to handle trucks out of Hampton Roads is still part of the purpose and need. There's a lot of disagreement as to what the port's actual position is in terms of their support. As we know, they are right now supposed to contribute $250 million to this project.
there's a new board, whether or not we'll see what we get permitted. So I don't want to suggest a minute, Mr. Matney, that that's not an important decision. I would say it's very political, and that we need to see there's no doubt that this could help the port getting trucks out. The urgency of it is the debated point, quite frankly. But we do. It also adds to hurricane evacuation access. So I've been a strong proponent of the project and still am for the purpose of need, but only when we can get permitted in that regard.
I think, Mr. Secretary, if I could add to that, I can't speak for the port at all. You're right, it's a new board and all that. But not all of these alternatives are as valuable to the port.
Right.
So when we look at practicality, whether it's from the Army Corps or from our, you know, we have to pay attention to that too.
Right, that's right. And their ability, you really get into the larger step, is that the best use of port monies? I mean, you know, in terms of what, so once we, I just want to say there's a lot of things we're going to have to bring to the table once we know what the road is. We have a contract that we will need to renegotiate or deal with depending on where we go. We have bonds on the project. Depending on what is permitted, we'll need to take decisions on. But where we are until Ms. Dean's group gets completed, that we are at the best point we could hope for, a standstill with our private partners. They're working with us in that regard. And our federal partners are working, I think, at a very good pace, very cooperatively, to get this decision made.
Secretary.
Mr. Krasinski.
But on the big picture, the big boats are still coming through that Panama Canal, and they're going to be coming through at a certain time certain. And we're interstate competition still.
That's correct.
How do we move freight with the Savannah Harbor, Charleston, Port of Baltimore, et cetera. So
right.
That's still out there as a real economic concern.
Yeah, I was in Miami last week, and their port is certainly preparing at breakneck speed. So, yes.
Secretary, how is the private partner involved in this process, other than just agreeing to stand aside for the time being?
Right now the SEIS is being handled through VDOT. I'll let the commissioner respond. They are working up until this point, there are some of the inputs that the private partner developed that went into a lot of this process. But right now, the only monies being spent are through VDOT, at least through the state, are being spent through VDOT. Working to get this SEIS. In full disclosure, I know there are monies at the 460 Funding Corporation. They have disclosure requirements. They have ratings by the bonds. They have those issues going on that are being still not a great deal of money, but some money being spent to keep that entity compliant with its bonds. Regulations until we know as to where we're going with this project.
The supplemental EIS is being conducted by VDOT, not by the 460 Mobility Partners or their engineering companies. So this work is being done by VDOT in cooperation with the Corps of Engineers and Federal Highway Administration. We are keeping the 460 Mobility Partners, that's the design build team. We're keeping them generally informed of what's going on, but not looking for their consent, nor are we utilizing their resources, except for, as the Secretary indicated, there was a lot of groundwork that they had done as part of their permit application on the Corridor 1. So we're able to work with them and their consultants to get that information. But beyond that, again, this is a VDOT effort being done at this time.
But they are involved and willing participants at this point, willing from a standpoint
They have agreed to a standstill. We are Charlie's team, Garrett, and Quentin have all worked keeping the contacts going. But I would expect them to, while I do believe they want to work with us going forward, I think it'll all depend on what that is, and I expect them to act in whatever they think their best interest is. But having said that, hopefully that'll be working with us. They are hopeful to have other participation, not only in Virginia, but in the United States. And they have been, up to now, said all the right things, been very receptive to where we are. Mr. Casper?
Are we making any payments to them in this whole period?
No.
So it's shut down?
Shut down. Mr. Malvin?
Secretary, I'm in the worst position you ever be in to have pregnant.
Well, I might be pregnant, might be worse.
And the purpose of need, I understand the value of the port, and I understand the evacuation and safety. The other component's always had an interest in my region, hopefully shared in Richmond, is that the economic opportunities that will come along that corridor, not only in supporting, leveraging port's activities, but having greenfield sites for economic development and long-range planning about how to connect that corridor has a lot of value from my standpoint. You don't get that immediately, but you don't get it if you don't have the infrastructure for it. There's a lot of ways to look at this thing, but long-term, the Commonwealth and the Richmond and the main approach area, I think, is part of it.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, the purpose and need, while we've talked about other things, it definitely included is the economic activity that could occur along the corridor. Back to Mr. Krasinski and the port, port-related businesses that come out of it in their regard. So, again, I think the purpose and need, and I don't mean to be technical term, but the reason behind having an enhanced 460 or an additional 460, whatever, it is still very, very valid. But we've got to make sure that we have a permittable project in that.
Secretary?
Yeah, Mr. Cole.
Obviously, having an enhanced 460 affects the localities in a totally different fashion than
right.
a separated toll facility. Has there been any consideration to using a process similar to what we did on Route 29? If, in fact, we get to the point of needing to do an enhanced 460.
Yeah, and I'll let Ms. Dean, expand upon what the outreach we're doing, but a lot of that's going to be done with this new outreach. She's starting to this month on outreach and different things. But another issue with this project was the outreach from the very beginning. Mr. Krasinski asked about our congressional and legislative outreach. There was not consensus among that group as we went down the path we went down. I'm not saying we're going to get consensus, but we realized outreach is just as important as the actual, and I think we've talked about this before, building of these structures. So that is an important part of where we're going from here. This open process where we're dealing, again, you may not agree, but you will be informed. And I'll let Ms. Deem talk about what we're doing.
Yeah, I would just add to that, as soon as the five build alternatives were solidified, we went out and met with each of the jurisdictions so that they understood what was under consideration. We asked for information from them about their planning efforts and how they included the assumption of alternative one essentially being implemented versus these new alternatives and how that might change things for them and what challenges it presented or opportunities that it may present. So we have that information for the draft. I think our focus is to get to the end of the year and have the federal agencies identify the preferred, and then from there we would fit our outreach plan going forward based on the identification of that preferred. But these town halls, and really in advance of the town hall meetings, there have been numerous outreach by the 460 Project Office at every Board of Supervisors meetings and other meetings to ensure that folks stay informed as we move through this process, since we've introduced quite a bit of uncertainty in the region. But the town halls are really meant to help give folks an opportunity to vet their questions, get them prepared for the public hearings where we will formally solicit comments, and I'm sure that will also include resolutions by boards and supervisors, et cetera. And we'll bring all that to the CTB for your consideration as we move forward.
Okay. Ms. Dean, thank you very much. That is one of the things, these three projects, these major projects, I continue, will continue to bring in front of you to make sure that you are updated as the rest of us. I think we'll do Mr. Donahue's presentation, and then we'll get our take a quick break for get a snack here or lunch here. So, Mr. Donahue, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and speak with you. Going to have hopefully a good presentation and dialogue here about the implementation of House Bill 2. As members of the board may remember, in May, we had an overall briefing about the broader calendar and schedule for the implementation of House Bill 2, with really the end goal of having a six-year program adopted in June of 2016 that's based on this process. And working backwards from there, you know, we're going to have candidate projects and run those through kind of a measuring process to score those, likely in late 2015. And so, with that, again, we'll need to have measures in place by probably mid to fall of 2015. So remember, that's kind of the overarching calendar, and what I want to walk the board through now is kind of the initial steps that we have taken to move forward with the implementation of House Bill 2, and really importantly, get input from a lot of the public and other stakeholders as we do this. So I believe Ms. Mathis is passing out a memo that Secretary Lane has signed that kind of lays out some of the things I'm going to walk through here verbally with regards to the implementation of House Bill 2. And one of the first things that that memo talks about is the establishment of an executive work group, which will effectively serve as the staff working folks who will come together to develop recommendations, staff recommendations, to come back to this policy board for your discussion, consideration, and eventually at some point enactment. That work group will consist of myself, Commissioner Kilpatrick or his designee, Director Mitchell or her designee, a VDOT district administrator, another VDOT executive from the central office, and staff from the Office of the Secretary of Transportation. And again, these folks are really the staff that are working for the board, because this is your process. At the end of the day, this has to be something that you all think captures the things that are important with regard to economic development, mobility, accessibility, safety, and environmental quality across the Commonwealth that will be a tool for you to use to select projects. So they're going to take input. They're going to report back to you all on a lot of these things. They're going to call you all, sit down with you, meet with you, and talk with you. But at the end of the day, this is the group that is effectively your staff on this issue. The group is going to be focused on four key things, and the most important one from my perspective is really outreach and engagement with the public and other elected officials. And so myself and other members of this work group are going to be going out across the state, and I'll talk about this in more detail later in my presentation, multiple times throughout the development of this process. So we're going to be doing it at the beginning, going to get input before we start to develop things, again later, after we've put in place some initial concepts, and then again later in that process. The other things that we'll be doing is working with the regions to help facilitate the weighting of the various factors. If you recall, there's at least five factors that will be used to score projects, and we're likely going to weight those differently in the different regions. And so these folks will be sitting down with community leaders, elected officials, private sector interests, and other folks in the different parts of the Commonwealth to really understand what are the things that are most important from those folks' perspective with regard to selecting transportation projects, and we'll again be reporting that information back to the board. Two other things that this group will be focused on is the funding and programming aspects related to House Bill 2. As we've talked about several times at board meetings, the implementation of House Bill 2 is going to require an off-cycle update to the six-year improvement program later this year. And so the programming staff, after a brief reprieve from the initial six-year programming update, are going to get back to work in this upcoming month to identify projects that are subject to House Bill 2 and will have their funds deallocated from them, because those projects must be run through House Bill 2 before we can commit construction funding to them.
Can I raise one point with that? It would be helpful to understand that process. It makes sense to me. If
CTV members for the district whose project are coming off could be notified prior there too. I think we missed that step last time.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's going to be important because questions are going to obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, sir. Yeah. We'll make sure of that. Yeah.
And so there's a tentative schedule that we've put in place for this update, and that's that the draft plan would be released in the September-October timeframe, ideally at the September board meeting for public comment and other things. We would then hold public hearings at the fall meetings, which is traditionally where we go around and talk about potential candidate projects that local governments and other stakeholders are interested in seeing included in the six-year program. And I believe this year the intent is to use those meetings both to help inform the public about the changes to the plan that were required by House Bill 2, but also to elicit additional candidate projects that we can consider as we move forward with the implementation of this process.
What's the grandfather clause here? I mean, what projects are going to not be subject to the prioritization process?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Williams, that's a very good question. So there's a host of funding categories as well as activities that are exempt from House Bill 2. So road and bridge repair, all of those projects will move forward without any impact with regard to these funds. The revenue sharing program is exempt from this process. The CMAQ, Highway Safety Improvement Program, and Transportation Alternatives federal funding categories are exempt from this. The regional surface transportation funds that by federal law the MPO controls will be exempt. And then of the remaining funds, there are still some projects that may be exempt from that, and those are projects that are fully funded and have previously completed the NEPA process.
Or under construction.
Yeah, I understand the rush.
Yeah. The key is, and what Mr. We don't want to eviscerate the program. We don't want to stop work. So that's what But on the other hand, we've got to by law got to get this going.
Yeah. Moving on, Mr. Chairman. So the other things that this group will be doing is taking a look at how do we start to align the prioritization process with the plan. And we really want to bring some recommendations to the board about that. There are going to be some hiccups as we move forward with that implementation of House Bill 2 on certain projects. The staff's goal is to minimize those to the extent possible. And the reason those are going to be in place is because we're doing this essentially mid-session on a six-year program. We're implementing a new process, and we're not starting a program from scratch. We're in the middle on some projects. But if we're successful with the implementation of this, what we will have is we will score projects and use those scoring to select what we advance to preliminary engineering and right-of-way to create a more sustainable, predictable program that provides better certainty to communities, businesses, and other folks across the Commonwealth. And so you'll see a project that will score. It will score well. The board will select it. It will go into the program in year 4, 5, or 6 for funding. And then the next year, it will move up to 3. And we can hopefully create that type of certainty where projects move up year after year in the program and we see them get scored, go to PE, go to right-of-way, and then move to construction in a very predictable basis. So that's one of the sub-working groups that this work group is going to put together. The next one that they'll be putting together is the one that's really going to look at how are we going to measure the outcomes of these various projects. And again, there's 5 criteria that the legislation has put in place, and we're going to really try and take a look at what are the ways that we can measure that that's fair and objective, but also importantly can work for different parts of the Commonwealth. We're a very, very diverse state, and I do think the ability to weight these factors differently in different parts of the state is very important, but we also need to make sure that how we're actually just measuring projects works for the different districts and areas across the Commonwealth. We've started some initial research on looking at how other regions and states who have implemented these types of processes, they're really what they've done. And we found that there's a fair amount of good examples out there that are worthy of consideration. So as a part of this work group, we're going to be establishing a peer group of experts from outside the Commonwealth. So they don't have a dog in the fight. They're not going to be looking to game the system for one region or another, but who have really worked on these processes in different regions and different states who can help vet some of the proposals or concepts that we're coming up with, but also let us know where they ran into pitfalls or some good ideas that they've come across that we might be able to implement that they were not. And I think that's a really important aspect as we move forward with this is other folks have done this and we need to learn from their successes and more importantly learn from their mistakes. And so we're really hoping that peer group can help inform staff so we can inform you all about some of the ways that we can best move forward with this process. I talked earlier, Mr. Chairman, about public engagement, and I want to just let the board know we have reached out to every single metropolitan planning organization across the state, pursuant to the provisions in the law, and are offering to sit down with them, their board, and their staff to talk a little bit about the House Bill 2 process and get their input on the front end as we move forward with these concepts and really understanding what do they think is the most important types of concepts with mobility before we predetermine kind of what we think is most important. So on the slide here, you see a few examples of places that we've been so far. We have numerous other places that we're going to be going over the next few months, but I also want to say that this is not a fully inclusive list. So please don't worry if you don't see your region or your MPO or your planning district commission on there. We're in we're in frequent communication with staff at all of the MPOs and planning district commissions on these aspects and are happy to go and sit down with all of them throughout this process. One of the other things that we're planning with regards to public engagement on the House Bill 2 process is we're going to have these staff working groups that will come up with a straw man proposal after we receive input from the board about ways in which we could measure projects and other things with regards to their impacts for these five factors. Once we do that, we're going to set up regional forums across the Commonwealth where we will go and meet with the local government officials, the transportation planners, the private sector interests, and other folks all in one room to talk through what some of the concepts are that we've put in place and, again, most importantly, get their feedback on what whether that does or doesn't work for their region. Get their feedback on what are some of the weighting factors or other things that are important. Is economic development most important for their region, or is it congestion? And so these regional forums will likely start late this year and carry into next year after the General Assembly session. And the goal is, this is the second round kind of public input that we'll have once we have more things for folks to chew on. So Mr. Chairman, over the next few months, there's going to be several opportunities for the board to kind of weigh in. And I think some of the opportunities that they have is first, I walked Mr. Williams through the exempt categories of funding. However, as I've mentioned before, House Bill 2 does provide this board with the authority, if it chooses to exercise it, to establish prioritization processes for some of these other funding sources that are exempt. And so you wouldn't put these funding sources in the broader statewide prioritization process, but you may say, hey, the Highway Safety Improvement Program, perhaps we should have a prioritization process for how those projects are selected. And that's authority that was granted to this board by the legislation Governor Call signed. So I think that's one of the things that staff will be talking about and coming back to this board with recommendations for discussion and your input over the coming months. We'll also, as Mr. Fralin talked about, be coming back to you all with revisions to the six-year program required by House Bill 2 for your input and consideration. Some of the other things that are important that we have to start working on now is we're going to be deallocating projects in the program if they're subject to House Bill 2, but I think the legislation also envisioned that we wouldn't just assume those were the only projects that should get scored. In effect, when the legislature put in place this prioritization process, they said, consider more things. Score them and make sure you pick the best projects. And so we need to develop a process by which we solicit candidate projects from local governments, from regional authorities, MPOs, transit agencies, and other stakeholders, and score those against some of the other projects that we've deallocated as we work forward towards the six-year program that will be adopted in June of 2016. And then the last one, and is again very important, is we will be coming back to the board several times in the coming months with regards to concepts about how we could measure some of the outcomes and factors that are required by the legislation. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Tom.
When we look at regions, how are the regions shaping up? Are they following the lines of districts?
Mr. Chairman, Mrs. Tom, that's a very good question. She really said, how are we going to weight this? Is it going to be the same across the district? Are we looking at district boundaries? And I think that's some of the stuff that this executive work group will be talking about. And again, coming back to the board. Before we come back to the board, though, we do want to get more input from some of the different regions and the local elected officials there to get their take on some of those things. I do think right now the legislation kind of talked about by district, But as you look at some of the districts, you know, Northern Virginia is generally a pretty urbanized district. I think we'll see kind of broad consensus with all the local governments within that district about, you know, we're urban, one uniform weighting factor will work for us. If you take a look at the Fredericksburg district, you have a very urban aspect of that district on the western end, and then the northern neck and middle peninsula are very, very rural. And so I do think we may end up having different weighting within some districts. You have the same thing in the Richmond district. You know, Mr. Cole knows about that. So I think those are some of the things we're going to talk to local governments about and come back to the board right now. But I do think there likely will be some differences within districts.
Mr. Kasper.
Yeah, who makes the final decision on the weighting for this criteria on a region-by-region basis?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kasper, it's this body. So the legislation vests all of the authority with regards to the measures that will be used, the weighting of those factors in the different regions with this body, and then this body will use the information provided by that process to select projects. Again, this process does not dictate the project selected by the board. It does not say that if a project gets a 95 and one gets a 94, that this board must select a project that gets a 95. What it does is creates a transparent, accountable process where if there's a project that got a 10 and a project that got a 90 and this board chooses to fund the 10, people are probably going to ask some questions. And I think that's really what it puts in place. But it's the intent of this process is to empower this board and to create a more transparent and accountable process to the public.
But we'll make the decisions on the actual weighting of the five factors.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kasper, the final decision rests with this board.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, quick question, and it may be a little ahead of itself. It's obviously a good thing that the process can weigh different factors within different districts. When you get to the potential concepts for measuring outcomes, can those also be weighted differently in different districts in the sense that a result from an economic development perspective in one district may be different or in an urban area may be different than the economic benefit in a rural area? So can those have different weightings on the outcomes?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rosen, I think I want to get back to you on that one. I think there may be some flexibility to the board with that. I think we'd want to talk to some of these peer experts that we're hoping to convene who have implemented some of these processes across the country and maybe come back to the board with some additional, more informed dialogue on that subject.
But the theory is that this board will look at some very rural project and compare it to some very urban project and determine in any different and determine what is the next best use of monies for the Commonwealth. So while I think Mr. Arnie's right, we'll look, the intent of this law is for you to make those, you can't say, well, that's number one in this district and that's number one in this district. It's the intent is to say which one comes next. You can't have five number ones. Again, the law doesn't say you line them up and do them in order, although I will tell you many legislators have that expectation. But that's not what the law says. But it is forcing us to make the decision that this is the next best use of transportation dollars. That is really what the intent of the law is.
And I completely understand that. My point is simply that one lane mile of road in an urban center may have 3x benefit over a lane mile in a rural area. And there's statewide transportation funds, so while it may not impact as many people in one area, if we're weighting...
That's the weighting. That's why the economic development gets weighted more than congestion mitigation in the rural areas. You're right.
Outcomes, it seems like we need to look at just a thought for now.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, Mr. Hyde made the right answer. But I want to point out, though, that we can't get to the end and say we have 50 number ones. Now, another part to your question is equity. I mean, theoretically, you could line them all up and they all go to one district. Theoretically. I don't think that's going to happen, but theoretically. So equity. So we got to work through that. But Mr. Rose, I understand. But I want to make clear the intent is to have a program where we're accountable for why that is the next dollar spent. that was made clear.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add on to that, to your point, Mr. Rosen, the other thing that is in the law that we've talked about before, but I want to remind the board of, is it's not just aggregate benefits. It's benefits on a unit cost basis. So earlier, the board heard a presentation from Renee Hamilton on the I-66 project. That's a multi-billion-dollar project. It likely will have aggregate, not likely, it will have benefits, aggregate benefits that exceed a road widening, say, in the Roanoke or Salem area. However, both of those are then going to be compared on a unit cost basis, which I think should help level the playing field across the Commonwealth, because projects in those urban areas do cost more. And so those are some of the things, again, that might help address some of those concerns, but we will raise that with the peer group, the issue that you brought up, Mr. Rosen, and get some of their input and dialogue on that.
And the last point you made,
And that's right. I mean, look, if you look at the federal laws, the MAP 21 forced to look at aggregate benefit. Our law is looking at project benefit. So to use federal money is going to have some of that. I mean, but you're right. I just wanted to, that's really what it is. Mr. Fraylor?
I want to make sure I understand exactly what we're talking about here, because this district-by-district piece, we don't have any money to spend district-by-district right now. Mm-hmm. We spend it all through the Commonwealth CTB formula. So there's going to be a CTB formula, and then there's going to be a formula for each construction district that would, once we start getting money flowing through it, be how we would allocate it pursuant to that. Am I right about that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fraylin, the way the law is currently structured, and at the end I'm going to tell you an X factor that might change what I'm getting ready to describe to you, but the way this works is House Bill 2 does not change the current funding allocation formulas that are in place. So under the CTB formula, which the board currently is choosing to use, 25% of that $500 million is set aside for statewide high-priority projects. So under the House Bill 2 construct, as it currently is in place, there would be projects from across the state that would be candidate projects as high-priority projects. One from Mr. Garzinski's region would be scored highest based on congestion, and then the other factors would be ranked based on the preferences of the officials from that area and the vote of the board. A project from your area would then be voted, would be scored based on how, you know, the highest priorities there. So I imagine congestion would be lower than things like economic development and safety. And then the overall scores for both of those projects would be compared, and both of those projects would be eligible for funding under that high priority funding allocation, with their benefits measured on a unit cost basis. And so you, as let's just say there's Project X from Northern Virginia and Project Y from Salem, and in that there could be a, you know, an 80 from Northern Virginia, and just because I don't want to get into controversy, an 80 from Salem. And then the board would have to pick which of those projects to fund, or it might fund those two and not fund several others from across the state.
But the CTB formula, in theory, goes away in 3 years.
I think Mr. Donner is going to get to, we may, as we go through this, choose to make changes before that.
Right, and the law says that we can allocate up to $500 million pursuant to that. We don't have to.
That's right.
So I'm getting all that, but I just want to make sure that you understand, Nick, because we are going to have to make that final decision, and it's not going to be, I'm not sure everybody completely understands how hard that's going to be, because the environmental people are not going to want the same as the home builders.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So there's going to be a tension that we're going to have to decide amongst ourselves, and so we need to be really involved in this process.
There's a letter in front of you that is to how these are going to be set up, and in that regard, Mr. Donahue mentioned that we got to get you some preliminary information to work with. I mean, in other words, I mean, just turn you out there and say, go do it.
Right.
So that's what this. Now, we then hope to set up liaisons on these various areas. And Mr. Donahue will be in touch with you over the next few weeks as we make those. And you're not delegating any authority. It's all going to be debated in this room what we decide. But liaisons to work with these various components as we go through this process so that the CTB is involved.
But when it comes down to deciding, it's going to be debated in here and voted in this room. So that's how we envision the process. But getting these staff groups up to speed first so they have some information for you to consider. I mean, you know, it, you know, otherwise, yeah, you know. But we,
Mr. Chairman, to Mr. Fralin's point, I think as we go out and meet with the MPO boards and present to them, it's our hope and intent to coordinate with the CTB members and bring them into those discussions, as well as for the broader regional meetings, to make sure we schedule those so that they work for the CTB members to attend, hear all of that dialogue, and that executive work group, whose members I showed in the first slide and who are in the memo, before you will be reaching out to each member of the CTB to discuss this process as we move forward. So I want to make that public commitment to each member of the board, because we will be doing that as we move forward with the implementation. And to your earlier point about the formula, there is language in the enacted budget that directs the secretary to review the various funding formulas that are in place, or allocation formulas, excuse me, to determine whether or not the needs of local governments, regional agencies, and transit agencies are being adequately met, and to make any recommendations back to the General Assembly by December of this year. And so I do think there will be a side discussion that's not a part of the HB2 implementation, but that will involve the board, where there will be discussions regarding the funding allocation formulas and whether or not any revisions are necessary based on the budget language. But I suspect we may also talk about whether or not, because of how House Bill 2 works, there aren't other changes that might be helpful.
That's exactly right. In other words, we to do that without at least considering House Bill 2 and what its effects, I'm not, you know, we wouldn't be getting a, I don't think, a good answer. So, Mr. Whitworth?
I think everyone around this table works pretty carefully with a tight calendar and schedule, so I would encourage whenever those dates are set that as early as possible, those dates be communicated.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Nick, are you aware, are other states using a similar prioritization practice? And if so, will we look to get input regarding hurdles and other issues that they went through in the developmental process? Or will that, you're looking for the University of Transportation Center's think tanks to provide you with that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cole, I think we're going to be looking at a mix of those things. And so we've done an initial scan of various states as well as metropolitan planning organizations to look at who has in place prioritization processes. More regional planning organizations tend to have these in place, and so I think we may end up relying on those a bit more than states. North Carolina, however, is currently in the process of developing a prioritization process. The way their measures may not be applicable to what we're looking at here in Virginia, they have a lot of output-based measures based on like shoulder width, lane width, and things of that nature, but the way they run their process with regards to soliciting projects, communicating with the public, and other things might provide some valuable insight, I think, to the board. But it is our sincere intent to talk to other folks who have done this and understand what's worked well and what hasn't worked well so that we can capitalize on, you know, the good parts and avoid the bad.
I think that's important. I think regional bodies are going to tend to have more consistency of agreement just because of the nature of the geography, as opposed to a state, which, you know, is obviously dealing with the same kind of thing. Thank you.
Mr. Ma, oh, Mr. Tong.
Thank you. Just to be clear, the projects that are going to be deallocated are projects that have not been fully funded and have met the environmental review?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Tunk, the projects that the programming staff are currently going through the program to identify are capacity expansion projects that are not funded through, you know, MPO-controlled funds, that are not fully funded or have not completed the NEPA review process.
Small?
Tying a little bit on to her question at the allocation process, I'm assuming, tell me if I'm wrong, that in the current six-year plan, when we go through this HB2 scoring process, there may be projects that are in various stages within the plan, and the allocation, I assume, terminates the project. So if we have a project that we've already spent the money on the PD, the right-of-way, environmental, and approaching construction phase, we would have to make a decision to walk away from that project.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mulvin, I think in the circumstance that you described, typically the projects that have advanced through PE right-of-way and NEPA completion, because we have a six-year program, likely are fully funded for construction, so those would be exempt. But if they were not, say there was a project where we maybe had done partial PE and it wasn't fully funded through construction, we might make the decision to deallocate funds from that project and make that a candidate project that then would have the opportunity to receive funding through the House Bill 2 process and would come back to the board. So as we're currently talking through this, it's envisioned that every project that's deallocated or loses money, it's not dead in perpetuity. It's a project that would just be scored with other candidate projects under the House Bill 2 process.
Yeah, and our initial screenings have not picked up. There's a whole bunch of stuff out there that doesn't need to get done. I mean, so, you know, we didn't go through there and find, oh, look at this, you know, there's a whole bunch of fluff. As you well know, we've been dealing with limited resources. So as Nick has pointed out, it's really just a matter of how it stacks up and how the funding may fall out. I mean, that, but I don't see a whole lot in there. I don't think, Nick, your investigations and the chart, we've seen a whole lot of anything that said, oh, that's just a project that shouldn't get done. It's more relative.
And Mr. Chairman, also to your point, Mr. Mulvin, a lot of the projects up front are fully funded through construction, and so the projects that are going to be deallocated are more in the out years of the program, and so it's projects that really haven't gone very far in the development stage, for the most part, is our initial, it's what our initial analysis is showing.
Yes, Mr. Cole?
We have projects, I'm sure, throughout the state that are capacity adding and have pieces of CMAQ money or others in it, but not total. How do you deal with those?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cole, that is something that the Funding and Programming Work Group is going to, one, we're going to try and identify the universe of those projects, and then based on that universe, we'll need to develop kind of some rules that will govern how those move forward. In the projects that I've seen so far, and I want to be candid, it's not the universe. In a lot of instances, because the MPOs control the CMAQ money, it's typically co-invested with regional surface transportation funds, and both of those funding sources are exempt. So I'm not sure whether or not there will be a large set of projects that fall into that, but that is something that we'll be looking at.
But for you guys that have been on the board a while, you know that basically the executive team, the secretary, working with VDOT, sets the table for these projects. And you also know that by the time you get to they got to you, there was very little changes that happened. And a lot of that was driven from administration to administration and through the political process. I'm not saying it's good or bad, it's just that's the way it worked. This process puts that really in the CTB's hands. Now, yes, it's got some objective criteria, hopefully objective, but that goes away. This really puts the funding of projects squarely in the hands of the CTB. The way it's got to be looked at, which you develop. So the idea is to develop a process that goes from administration to administration, time to time, delivering to DDOT, DRPT programs that have been scored and are worked on, and that we don't have. We're fighting a pipeline process now. We don't have projects that have been defined because come in, this is my priority. So I'm not suggesting the political process will not be important, but I am suggesting that in terms of allocating money, this law puts a lot more of the responsibility and authority of how the six-year plan is developed in the CTB. So. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good presentation to you. Guys, it's about 20 to 1. You want to take about 10 minutes to get a lunch? And then we'll start back up to get through these things and get to our work session. Cycle, where we are as an agency and the internal workings, and also as to how we move forward with our project and program development. Having said that, we also try to key in
the development principles of V-Trans 2035, as well as our strategic planning and efforts that are reported through the Department of Planning and Budget and DOA as well. Having said that, we also bring forward in the business plan the report of our efforts and initiatives that we have moved forward on over the past and prior year, and then also our business plan initiatives as to how we move forward on the upcoming year. Fundamentally, I think, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, we have some key actions supported that I want to bring to your attention in this upcoming year. We're going to have the continued advancement of the Dulles Corridor Metro Rail Project. As you all know, there's a major milestone and celebratory effort coming up at the end of this month with phase one of that project coming into service. We also will initiate planning and engineering design for rail improvements in consideration of the expansion of Amtrak Virginia service in Virginia as well, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. We are a state that has now gone from being a commonwealth without state-supported Amtrak service to one that's growing across the country as being a leader and pacesetter in the development of intercity passenger rail in the United States. Having said that, with the Intercity Passenger Rail Operating Capital Fund, we have some great initiatives to move forward on, as well as we will see in the development of further business plan initiatives to include, once we continue with Director Mitchell made mention earlier about the discussions that we have ongoing with our Class I railroads, and also Amtrak on the second frequency of Lynchburg, we'll see that come in as a BPI later throughout the year. And that's a good point to point out is that the business plan is a document that shows a snapshot of where we're headed and our intentions of moving forward, but it's also a living document as to how we will go about as an agency conducting business throughout the year. As we have projects that will run into further planning and development and then go into the funding and contracting phase, very similar to how you will see on page 18 of the business plan where the Virginia Beach project will move forward in an iterative process. We also have other projects, like I mentioned, Lynchburg, as well as Columbia Pike, and other efforts that will move forward as BPIs as we continue to mature those discussions throughout the business year.
Yeah, Mr. Page, may I interrupt just for a minute?
Yes, sir.
You mentioned a couple of the light rail projects we have, one being in Virginia Beach, which Director Mitchell and Kevin have been working with Virginia Beach and getting that grant approved or ready. That's roughly $155 million, up to $155 million, or 50%. Kevin also mentioned the Columbia Pike, and it's effectively, I guess, affectionately been called a streetcar or whatever, but it's really light rail. It's the same car that we're looking at for the city of Virginia Beach, an extension of the Tide. In the six-year plan, there was roughly, I think, $220 million set aside for fixing guardrail, and this was one of the projects that we had identified in that six-year plan. So I wrote a letter to the chairman of Fairfax in Arlington to let them know that after due diligence performed by DRPT, Director Drake, I'm sorry, she's Mitchell, we would be willing to work with them on the advancement of that program and that. And had identified $65 million, the difference between the $155 and the $220 that had been set aside, as a starting point to work towards a grant, with the similar terms being up to 50% as we walk through the program. Of course, it would be much more than that, but they would be available to the other normal grant programs in there. That letter has, as all these projects did, just like it did in Virginia Beach, has stirred a little bit of controversy because in many projects you have proponents and you have the opponents. But I wanted to address a couple things today just to hit them head on. This was not a, as some have said, a snap decision and a payback. This project has been out there for years. I mean, in fact, the CTB was the one that approved the alignment for this. It is connection. It's about 7 miles. I'm sorry. About 7 miles connects with the Crystal City, and then Bus Rapid Transit in the Alexandria area in there. So it's part of a component program. It's the next step from the Metro Rail that Kevin mentioned in addition to corresponding with the bus services that are in the areas in that regard. So from a transportation perspective, it appears to be a logical next step. Obviously, Arlington and Fairfax have done a lot of due diligence. It's their preferred alternative. They've worked through in that regard in determining this particular project. I toured the project personally right after being in office. I've been up there a couple times with them and looked at the project. So this is not something that came about in the last month or so. In that, it's been continuing dialogue that's been going on between the Department of Rail and Public Transit and my office and in evaluating the project. Criticism has been levied in several areas, one being that, well, you could have, larger buses could service this. That was looked at in the study. There are no buses large enough that have been approved by the transit authority in the United States that would fulfill this need. Those that are larger, that may be in some other countries that are in use, have to work on dedicated roadway. We do not have that here. This has to be open to both vehicular and fixed skyway traffic, just like it is in Norfolk on the Tide down there. So the space, we have space requirements in that regard. In fact, Mr. Kilpatrick was with me on one of them, and that was one of his questions. So we looked at that. So this fact that there's these buses available, possibly none for this purpose, none approved by the Federal Transit Authority for use in this country in that. The other has been criticism of a return on investment. This is a 35-year roughly program for this particular light rail project. That's about three times what the buses would be if they were to be used. So if you look at the total, the life cycle, it's about the same return on investment. And in fact, by the time if we did go the bus route, by the time we used them, they'd be out of date because it's projected up to 45,000. These are riders per day. This is the most heavily trafficked area and pretty much in the Commonwealth in terms of local ridership in that. This is not something that was just not, we hadn't done due diligence on, but I'll point out it's continuing. What we have said is that we look to work with you as you develop the program. So you will have to then decide, as we'll come to you, and the Director Mitchell will come and present to us once we've decided to get to the grant to allocate the monies to the program. But it was an expression to work with them in developing it in that regard. So I just want to point that out, what we were doing, why it was done. We do think it is a good transportation alternative, good fix, next good step for up there. People are going to say it's all politically motivated. I'm only addressing to you what has actually come here. One thing, there was a roughly $650,000 announcement made, and some characterize it as public outreach. Others say a publicity campaign. In an abundance of caution, I've asked them to say none of the state monies will be used for anything in regards in that manner. However, I would say there's also other monies on this. That's a requirement that you have outreach so the public knows. But as an abundance of caution, we're not going to put any of our monies on that because it only should be used for the purposes of getting information to the public. So I wanted to let you know what was going on, what was behind it. There will be a much more in-depth presentation to you to the extent we do work out the grant. But we've reserved these monies. To the extent the program works out, we'll be coming to you with a recommendation. So I just want to let you know what was going on there look forward, and hopefully this will be successful because I think it would be a logical step. The governor campaigned on having a seamless local or regional network in both Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads, and this is part of it. So anyway, just want to give you some input on that. So didn't mean to disrupt you, sure. But I thought it was a good time to just let the board know exactly what was going on because, you know, there's a lot of political opposition and proponents that are going back and forth, and I just want the board to know where we were.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, and thank you for that dialogue, Mr. Chairman, because going back as far as fiscal year 2009, that six-year program that was adopted by this board, it was very clear that we started funding this project in 2009. Right. And part of the business plan, the way we conduct business at the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, it's not just that we're a funding agency, but we're also hand-in-hand with the development of these projects. You know, we've grown up a lot as a state agency, and also our projects have become much larger in magnitude and also more demanding in the oversight function that we provide and also the engineering and technical support. We have an engineer of record on staff now. We are marshaled as an agency. Dave Harland helped construct he was an engineer of record with the WMATA Metro system, has been hand-in-hand with Arlington as they've moved forward with this project. We also have a funding staff in Northern Virginia that's headquartered now, seconded in the VDOT office in Northern Virginia, who has also been very critically involved with this project as well. So we are moving forward with this project in our normal way of doing business, and we've also created what we refer to as the multiple-year funding program, which is also a new way we do business this year with our agency, where we have the ability to take these longer lead projects, set them up in a multiple-year construct and financing and funding program, where we have milestones and efforts through our business plan process as well as to how we have the checks and balances in place. Just like you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, as we move forward with this project, we will bring this forward as BPI initiatives as we move forward in the development of the project, very similar to how we've done Dulles and also Virginia Beach is how it's evolving as well. So moving forward with that, Mr. Chairman, as you all enjoy your meal, the business plan becomes a little bit more enlightening and exciting in the back of the document, where we talk more about how we'll be focusing on our funding programs. We have three major initiatives as we move forward. So I'll draw your attention to page, I believe it's page 14 of the document as you read forward at your leisure. Having said that, in this construct, we again get back to that three-legged stool as to how we will move forward. And it's not just planning and programming and project development, but we have a very strong financial presence as well as the oversight. Jamie Motley will be presenting in Steve Pittard's absence. I hope he's enjoying his vacation because he needed a good break from the office. But we have a very strong financial oversight presence. Again, we treat this public funding. We have a discipline at the office where we treat this money as though it's our own. You know, we're stewards of state funding, and we move forward with that. And our business plan is very reflective of that as to how we move forward. And one of the changes we've made in the business plan this year, which we felt was very good and fundamental, was the way we project and talk about our business plan initiatives. We have initiatives that there are 31 initiatives that we can say we are going to achieve within the 12 months as special standalone BPIs. But we also have ongoing BPIs as to how we will develop long lead projects like the one the Secretary just talked about, as well as others that I've mentioned in the dialogue today, that are overarching ongoing BPIs. They're BPIs that actually span over not one business plan year, but several business plan years. So you'll find those now being brought out to your attention in this document as well, as we will move forward with construction oversight and also long lead projects, as we've been very successfully connected with the board and its great policy leadership, and also with Director Mitchell coming on board, as to how we're now teaming not only with our local governments, but teaming within the organization of DRPT, as to how we will move forward with a lot of efforts in a very uniform fashion, and how we bring that construct for the project delivery and the best investment and delivery of the public good for the Commonwealth. So, Mr. Chairman and Director Mitchell, I'll turn the floor over to you all for any further comments you may have on the business plan.
I have one question. The second train to that Allison asked about that is part of this plan. I know there's going to be one train that's going to originate in Roanoke. Will both those trains originate in Roanoke, or just one?
Mr. Chairman and Member Fralin, it's a very good question, and one that gets back to, again, the sound investments of state funding. We will, when Amtrak's train is extended to Roanoke, there's an overnight turning and storage facility improvement and investment that was made by the Commonwealth for the Lynchburg service proper. What will occur is that the Lynchburg train today will be extended to Roanoke, and the new train service will actually originate and terminate out of the Lynchburg facility that would otherwise be remained as unused during that extension. So we'll have a Lynchburg origination and then a Roanoke origination as well.
Well, all right. Is that just so we can use something we've already built, or
We are not making in the Lynchburg Toronto improvement, sir. We're only purchasing one train slot. So in order to run two round trips, we would have to go back to Norfolk Southern and negotiate additional capacity improvements between Lynchburg and Roanoke.
Mr. Connors.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Sorry to miss this, but how does this integrate with HB2?
Well, Director Mitchell?
Yeah, this gets back to the point Kevin made also about this being a bit of a living document. Our role in HB2 implementation isn't specifically addressed in here yet. I expect that'll be added. At this point, the main source of our transit capital funds are not, or our rail funds are not subject to HB2, but to the extent that transit projects could compete for other sources of funds, including highway funds, they would do it through HB2. So we'll obviously, as Deputy Secretary Donahue alluded to before, will be a key part of the team that looks at how both highway and transit projects are evaluated in HB2, and I think that'll be reflected further in later iterations of this as well.
Okay.
Great. Mr. Pace, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Made my sandwich enjoyable. Thank you. Okay, who we have up? Okay, so we have Mr. Motley. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. It's a pleasure to be here today. I just want to let you know that Mr. Pittard is on vacation, but his email functionality is working quite well still. So, I'm just going to talk very briefly about our quarterly financial update. You'll notice it says draft, and the reason it says draft is this is based on preliminary data. The state's accounting system will close next week, and we'll provide a final report to you by the end of this month with a cover letter showing all changes. And the main thing I want to get across today is that there is a shortfall in the mass transit trust fund this year. It's not something we haven't dealt with before. We have ways to deal with it, which I'll talk a little bit about in the next couple of slides. So this is basically just the reconciliation we do, and we do it every quarter. It actually happens every day in our everyday business, where we're just making sure that we have available resources to cover our commitments that are in the six-year program. The key outputs of this are if we need additional funding for new projects, for off-cycle grants, if someone comes in for a new and really good project that we want to put money on, then we can show that we have this money available to put on these projects. It's also to let the board know that these monies are available. It also helps us to manage our cash, accounts receivables, and estimated revenues. And estimated revenues is one of the ways we can deal with the shortfall that I spoke about. As you can see on this slide, this is a list of all of our unobligated balances by categories. You can see that the largest one right now is in rail, and that's in freight and passenger rail funds, and currently we are developing a rail resource allocation plan to align project needs with our available resources. Part of this balance came from a one-time general fund transfer a couple of years ago. I think it was $28.7 million, so hopefully that rail resource allocation plan we're going to have some good alternatives to use this money and put it to good use for the Commonwealth. Another number, if you look at transit, is we have $24 million of CPR bond funds. This is generally about what we've had left over after rolling funds forward and what we've got left over, but this is already anticipated to be allocated on several large projects in FY16. We've just started doing multi-year projects where we'll show a project out for 6 years, so this money will be spent with no problem at all. There's a lot of good projects to put that on. There's $11 million of federal funds, and this is a variety of different types of funding. Some of it's available because there's some old federal programs where monies are still being used, where MAP 21 has come into play, and so when those funds are being spent first until the new funds under MAP 21, they will be used. As you notice, the one we don't like to show is the negative $12.2 million for mass transit trust funds, and that is due to a shortfall. And the way we're going to deal with that is we're We'll look at deobligations we have during the year. If we have projects that come under budget, we'll use that to cover the shortfall. We can also reduce our revenue estimate for FY16 to a larger extent if necessary. The other way is we have, if you look right below the $12.2 million, you see that there's $3.7 million in our operating capital reserve. That money can be used, and a similar amount in the FY15 six-year program has been set aside. So that could be used to offset that as well. So we have ways to handle that. Like I said, this has happened before, so it's not something we're not used to dealing with.
Now, what caused the deficit? Was it the receipts? Or
just collections. Collections
were lower than expected.
Yes,
so when you obligated it, they came in less.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And then here you have a snapshot of our budget versus actual for the year. It's 18% versus overall versus 19% last year. If you had a chance to read the detailed report that was part of the board package, we talk about what we're trying to get to. We have about 2,000 grants, and we're working with project partners where we're not the direct owner of the project. We're a funding partner, basically. So it's harder for us to control these projects when we can't really make them happen. We have to work with our grantees to make them happen. So we think a good percentage would be 15%. Our goal is to get to 10, but if we can get within 15%, we feel like we could get to a pretty good place, because like I said, we're dealing with people who are they're the project leaders. They're in charge of the project. We're trying to help them along and push them along, but still we don't have as much control over some projects as we could. The public transportation variance is a little bit higher than it was last year, and a lot of this is just due to some larger capital type construction projects that are lagging behind. They're still going forward. They're just a little bit behind, so they should catch up in the next fiscal year. As I said, we do this. We get estimates from our grantees every year, but this requires coordination with our project managers, with our grantees, to get a good estimate, and sometimes it's just not easy to do. The rail variance is 27%, which is down from 54% last year. These are much larger contracts with complex negotiations. You're dealing with the Norfolk Southerns and the CSXs of the world, so sometimes ours is not the most important project of the day. Not that they're all not important. And that's all I have. I'll take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Motley? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Presentation. Mr. Lawson. Mr. Lawson, did you notice how long Mr. Motley's presentation was?
Sure. I'm going to try my best to follow through.
No, you make sure we understand what we got there, John.
Got to find the right one. Mr. Secretary, members of the board, largely what I'll be doing today is the same thing that you just saw from Mr. Motley. We're basing this off of preliminary numbers from Department of Taxation or Department of Accounts. The final numbers related to revenues really are not released until middle of August, when the Secretary of Finance will make presentation to the money committees. Well, what we've seen is that this for fiscal 14, the motor fuel taxes actually came in slightly better than forecast, which is a good thing. Sales taxes, retail sales and use tax, appears to have come in slightly below forecast. And I just want to point out here that the differences we're talking about now are the differences between the revised revenue estimate that was done in December versus the actual collection. If you recall back, for those that were here and those that, to inform those that weren't, in January, I think I made a presentation to this body talking about the revenue reductions that were in the December forecast compared to the budget that we were operating under. And at that time, we had actually identified about $30 million or so of reduced revenues that we no longer expected to receive in 14. And those revenue reductions were already planned to be addressed in fiscal 15. So we've already taken those into effect. It would appear, and this began collectively for the trust fund and for the HMO, not just for VDOT, that the difference between the revised forecast and actual collections is probably in the 15 to 20 million range. So, you know, it's sizable, but when you look at it in the scope of $3 billion worth of state revenues, you know, it's we've actually done pretty well. Just kind of an overview of spending activity this year from a VDOT perspective. Our spending this year was about $400 million greater than it was last year, about $4.7 billion. Sounds like a big number, but this is one of those cases that it's a paper number, because most of that $400 million relates to, or a very large portion of the $400 million relates to NVTA's share of the regional revenues that flow through us and we pay out to them as a local assistance payment. When you look at the total $4.7 billion, half of it, 50% of it, is related to maintenance. And that is looking at maintenance as a combination of what VDOT is spending, about 36% of the spending, and then the remaining portion, another 14% or so, related to the payments to localities that are provided to them to support maintenance within the urban areas. Construction also represents about 36% of spending, and you take note that when we look at work that is coming, we've got our existing contracts are, you know, $3.3 billion, which is over $500 million greater than the contracts we had out this time last year. So there's definitely a lot of work coming. Federal revenue, kind of the same thing you've been hearing all year. You know, federal revenues for those that are new on the body are driven based on, are totally reimbursements. You know, the federal program for highways is not a grant program where they provide us funds to be spent. We actually have to extend funds, demonstrate that we have expended eligible expenditures, and then seek reimbursement. So our spending activity is our collections are based upon spending. You'll see that this year we were about $100 million less than last year. But I want to point out that, you know, the $1.4 billion collected in 13, the $1.3 billion collected in 14, in both cases were greater than the roughly $900 million or so that we are actually expect to, or actually provided to the Commonwealth in a year. And the reason we have seen these higher levels of collections is that we have, over the last couple of years, we've been doing a significant amount of work that was funded in prior years. So we're actually gaining ground in terms of our expenditure activity, and not only in essence spending what we're getting each year, but spending some of what we've received in prior years and catching up.
John, probably on this slide is as good a place as any to talk about the preparation that we may have to take if in fact there is a curtailment of the federal revenues. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
I can, or if I have two
later.
Slides at the very end.
All right,
I'll hit it.
I want the board up and know what we're doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is just a graphic of spending by program compared year over year, and you'll see that there isn't a lot of deviation year over year, with the acceptance of that financial assistance to localities, and again, that is related to NVTA. This chart, for those that haven't seen it before, is something we started a couple years ago to give you an indication of what our budget is, the first column, what we thought at the beginning of the year we would actually spend, and then as the year progresses, we update our forecasted spending based on changes in schedules and estimates, etc., as we work through. And then we show on the right-hand side of the bolded line our actual spending against the forecast. And as you can see, we ended the year having spent about $11 million less than we thought. So again, that's a moving forecast, but all in all, it came in very, very close. Just speaking to a couple of the major programs from a standpoint of construction, we spent $1.7 billion, which is about 8% more than we spent last year, and the spending was about $30 million ahead of forecast. Looking at maintenance, we spent about $1.7 billion again, also $115 million alone in the month of June. That's about 4% above where we were last year. This does include our big snow expenditures. We had $326 million in snow costs this past year compared to the $157 million that we had planned for. And as you'll recall, back in back a few months ago, we did a budget revision and added an additional $92 million to the maintenance program to help offset that additional cost of snow.
Just a comment for those relatively new to the board. This spending to plan has been a work in process. I mean, several years ago, we would be hundreds of millions of dollars off as to what we planned. To be just a few million off one way or the other, if you look together, almost equal. That has been a credit to VDOT and its management of actually executing what they planned.
Secretary, have you sent an email to Mr. Miller?
Yes, I know. That's right. We still, you know, because that's something we've been on, and obviously we want to spend the monies wisely, but we want to spend them because of the needs across the Commonwealth. So good job, Mr. Kilpatrick. And I know it took some administrative help, too, there, John, so thank you.
And thank you for bringing that up, too, Mr. Secretary, because I wanted to point out that, you know, a few years back, you know, we had $400 million of unspent maintenance funds. Based on preliminary numbers, it looks like we're going to come in. It looks like, based on preliminary numbers, we're at about $30 million. We've got a few active transactions taking place between preliminary and final, and it is likely that we'll be in the $17-18 million range. So we have done an amazing job of bringing that amount down to right, basically zero.
Zero.
This just provides you kind of an overview of the two transportation regions, the two authorities. You can see there that the Hampton Road in Northern Virginia, the collections, their actual collections were almost exactly what was forecast. That was an amazing job there done by the Department of Taxation, I believe. Hampton Roads wasn't quite as close, and I think you can contribute that a lot to just the newness of the area, and taxation is yet to, you know, have history to help them with their forecasting. But all in all, you know, $10 million out of 157, they weren't too far off.
Yes, Mr. Williams.
What's the difference between on the expenditure lines, project activity versus transit? You send the money to Northern Virginia, but Hampton Roads tested grant?
No, up until July 1st, well, I guess still right now, was where we have had the first meeting, sort of. The money was held basically on the books of the Commonwealth for the use of the Hampton Roads region, where it was remitted to Northern Virginia. Effective July 1st of this year, with the Hampton Roads Transportability Accountability Commission, those monies are anticipated to be now transferred to them once they set their bank account up. We had hoped to have gotten through that at the first meeting. We were able to get through bylaws and a chairman. And so We're hopeful that they continue down that path and actually tell us where to send the money. In the interim, we did sign, I think we've run an agreement that is now being held for that entity versus the TPO, because that's what the agreement was before. But the no money can be spent from that without a voting that is required cooperation. So I don't expect to see any money spent out of that for a while, just to let you know. So that's what hopefully Ms. Johnson is, Deputy Secretary Johnson is assigned to that group. She'll be meeting tomorrow, and we are have been authorized to loan them money or stand them up to get their staff together, and so hopefully they'll get going.
Mr. Chairman, I followed some of the legislation, but not in detail. Is anything going away? Creating that, is there anything going away? You mentioned staff position. Is somebody else's responsibility going to be less?
Well, that's a discussion. This really, and if you're familiar with NVTA, Northern Virginia Transportation Alliance, they really sort of function more like a developer. That's really what this is, sort of a developer. They have the tools, the bonding, the tolling authority to put these projects together. So the TPO still has its planning function, and while there's some interplay, there certainly is a different role for HR TAC that is not being done currently in Hampton Roads. Where it is being done in Northern Virginia, I know there's some, the staff coordinate, but there is a different director needed. It's a different function. So we're working with them to hopefully get that process going. Yes. Ms. Traylor.
Well, and they are different. I mean, I think the Hampton Roads has to have a two-thirds vote.
No, actually, the voting is very similar to Northern Virginia. Yes.
Well, let me ask a question, though, on the, because why are we holding about $25 million?
That, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Traylor, that's a timing based on when the money comes in and when we pay it out.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we get collected, what is it, about 2 weeks or whatever that comes in. But On Hampton Roads, it's still showing because we haven't remitted it to anybody because we're still holding it.
We only have one project that the Hampton.
Yes, $40 million for the widening of 64 on the peninsula. I would direct any more questions on the HR TAC to the representative John Malvin over here. But you know, since he is an official member of the board, I am no longer a official member. But we have two ex officios here and another member over there, and Ms. Johnson. So we'll hope this group will get that organization going.
Well, that being said, I want to remind you I'm non-voting.
And that's
Secretary,
yes.
Going back to the years and looking at the information that we received, which was the best we could do at the time many years ago, and the information we received from Mr. Lawson now, you're really correct, and the information is so much improved and so helpful to know where we are within a few million.
As I said, I think they've done a very good job in terms of not only administration but execution, marrying the execution to what the numbers we see. So that's so. Okay.
All right. This is just a cash balance picture. What we're showing here is where we ended fiscal year 13 compared to where we ended fiscal year 14. And you can see that just overall the reduction of about $360 million. A large portion of that, as you can see, was spent down of bond proceeds. We will probably be back earlier in the spring. The board did approve us to move forward with another CPR bond issue. We stalled that with the issues around the state not having a budget, and obviously, you know, we were able to do that until times were better, and we will probably be bringing that back up over the next few months, and looking to do a sale probably September, October time period. Just kind of wrap up here. You know, you can see where Our preliminary data show that we are slightly low forecast, and again, the numbers I mentioned earlier were probably in the 15 million range. I think we've done a very good job this year of keeping our spending pretty close to what we had forecasted. And as you can see, that I mentioned this earlier, from a standpoint of the maintenance program, we have done a phenomenal job of bringing in, or fully utilizing, I'll say, the funds available to the program to help maintain and improve our facilities. I wanted to speak just briefly, as Mr. Chairman, as you mentioned before, on what's going on in Washington and how that potentially will impact us, possibly in as little as 2 weeks. As you know, the Federal Highway Trust Fund is forecasted to run out of cash, to become basically insolvent early to mid-August. So what they have done, what USDOT has done, as they are beginning August 1, will be implementing what they are calling cash management policy, in which they will not make payment after August 1 until they know what funds are available. And what they're going to do is, there's a lot of discussion about how they were going to make payment, whether they were going to just prorate what they had and give it to people, or you know, how to do it. Their equitable solution, which I think makes a lot of sense, is that they will distribute monies back to the states based on their share of the apportionment. So Virginia's share of the total program is 2.59%. So what they'll do is they receive their tax deposits twice a month. So what they'll be doing is, when they get their tax deposits in, of the amount then that they determine they can disperse, 2.59% is in essence reserved for Virginia. Based on Federal Highway's own estimates, that would equate to about somewhere between $1 and $1.2 billion a month. So when you turn that into receipts for Virginia, it's about 26 to 31 million a cycle, or $55-60 million a month. To put that in perspective, last August and last September, we collected on about an average of about 200 million each month. So there's potentially some very significant limitation on our reimbursements. And I will note that our reimbursements in August and September are typically high, because we're doing a lot of, a lot of construction activity, but two, we do a lot of what we call AC conversion of maintenance work that we did the previous years. It's part of just a strategy that we use for how we handle the federal program for maintenance.
Isn't there, this is August 1st then, but House just passed the stopgap bill, and now it's going to the Senate.
That is very
true. That could all happen.
Thank you, sir. But yes,
it could happen.
You're absolutely right. Just yesterday, the House did pass a bill that would put about $11 billion into the trust fund. Billion.
Yeah.
Did I say million?
I think you said.
Yeah, that wouldn't get us far.
That wouldn't get us stuff.
Yeah, it's $11 billion, which basically would carry the program at existing funding levels through May, if what the House's bill is intending to do. I think the Senate is scheduled to take up a measure next week, but I think theirs is shorter in duration.
I think they've reached a quorum on duration. I was reading this morning. Senate Majority Leader Reid is going to have three votes, one on the actual House bill, two, I think Senator Boxer had put a bill in, then there's a third bill, and I guess they will reconcile them, and whether it goes to conference or not and how long that process will take will determine whether or not we're impacted. And I just want, John's going to go through what we're doing. We've obviously been looking at this. We've been very vocal about this too, both in testifying, and I was on C-SPAN on Monday for 45 minutes about this. The president was in Virginia yesterday. Of course, he's submitted a $300 billion long-term fix, but have little chance, I think, of that getting done. But the key is that if we don't get the short-term fix, these are John's explaining what we're doing to not put anybody at risk. If it lasts 60, 90 days, and we know we're going to get money, then probably doesn't affect us a whole lot. We have cash flows. If it is curtailed, this $60 million a month, or $50 million would be $600, $700 million. Well, last year we got over $1 billion. Well, that's a pretty significant impact if they don't, if it goes to those curtailments. But even if they do, there's still no growth. I mean, it's been 20 years since that has been looked at. It doesn't help us long term. I mean, certainly it's great that they're going to fix it short term, which they've done since 2008 several times. But it's really hard for us to plan. We talked about Interstate 66, plan to put significant monies on a project when we're not sure, and I'm comfortable to say federal monies are going to be on that project. It's pretty hard to really plan through that if we don't have a long-term fix. But anyway, you're exactly right. Hopefully they'll vote get this resolved. There's questions between the offsets, what the money's coming from, but they got to resolve. And just so you guys know, this is in the 15%. The infrastructure spending is in the 15% of what they imply is discretionary spending, all within the entitlement programs that they have. Well, if you got rid of all of it, you still can't balance the budget. So, from our perspective, it's going to be hard to do that without dealing with these other issues. But they require offsets. So I don't know if that comes out of defense spending or where they get it from, but that's what their debate is on now. And that's so. Yeah, Mr. Walton.
The previous authorization, how long were they?
Well, there's the difference between the authorization and funding. MAP 21, I think, was put in about a little over 2 years, Nick. Yeah, 2 years, which we just got the rules and regulations pretty much laid out. That has to be reauthorized, too. Then it's funding, and that is the actual funds that, as John says, reimbursed. And that has typically, up until 2008, was the 18.4 cents per gallon tax. It started having issues in 2008. General appropriations have been used to shore it up since then. So they have reauthorized a bill, but they haven't funded it to the levels yet. But MAP 21 has not been reauthorized. It's up in September, I think, Nick, right? So I assume we'll just use the same guidelines until we get something else, but that also requires reauthorization and funding put in place. But we're immediately concerned about the funding. And one of the things we're going to ask the board to do is, and John will go through it, is to give the commissioner the authority to shift some money around to maximize our funding, because we won't meet again until September. That's what that resolution is that Carol was passed out. So, John, why don't you
get it?
No, 1993 is when 18.4 cents was last raised.
But
in 2008 is when it started, under their reimbursement, not meeting the obligations. And so instead of dealing with the funding that goes into the trust fund, they have chosen to do short-term, I think it's $50 billion, Nick, something like that, and four or five times they have put appropriations in, just like they're doing now. They'll put another $11 billion in. That supposedly will get us to May, but they really don't know, because it depends on what the authorizations are. All stopgap. And John, it requires, because of the rules they set upon themselves, reductions elsewhere. So if they find this $11 billion, supposedly they got to find $11 billion they're cutting somewhere. That's sequestration. I mean, that's basically what the rules are.
The House bill was income and taxes from deferred pension payments.
That's right. They didn't. You said the companies don't have to.
Defer their pension payments,
which will increase taxes because they don't get the deduction. And you know, but Speaker Boehner said, don't make fun of that. That is a hard decision. That was his exact comments. And I don't mean to be, you know, disrespectful to anybody, but I mean, you know, they have real world consequences as we're dealing with here as a board. And that's so.
Mr. Chairman, as you mentioned, and as I noted here on the last bullet, we are doing efforts to try to bring more cash in the door earlier to try to make sure we are, to help us during this period that we may see reduced federal revenue reductions. I mentioned earlier that the August-September collections last year, large portions of them were related to these AC conversions from the prior year. We are pushing forward full speed to get those conversions done before August 1st. We are also looking at other areas where we may be advancing or moving the use of bond proceeds with federal monies or other areas that can allow us to collect cash, you know, earlier rather than later to help us if we have to endure a period of time where the federal revenues are metered. Obviously, the very last thing we want to do is to have to start, you know, slowing our construction schedule or maintenance schedules in order to address a revenue. As Chairman, you mentioned, there is a resolution that's been circulated that will come before you under new business where we're just seeking the approval for the commissioner to be able to make approvals to do transfers, and again, these are transfers of previous funds, and really we're just changing the type of funding, taking a state dollar off a project and moving a federal dollar on a project to a project in order to be able to then do an AC conversion and collect monies sooner before they start limiting our resources. I think that as the resolution is laid out, it will be presented to the commissioner, and the commissioner will be notifying the secretary of the transfers, and then we will be making a full presentation to you and at the September meeting as to what transfers took place. But the whole purpose of this action is to help us maximize our cash revenue in to help us weather this period of uncertainty with the federal government.
Mr. Kilpatrick.
With federal government, with the lack of clarity about when this would be resolved, one of the things that I asked John and his team, a number of folks at VDOT, to do is to look at ways of cushioning and building some cash reserves if we were going to receive reduced reimbursements. So in a short-term period, we wouldn't impact ongoing contracts. So I think that was very important to us to not disrupt ongoing work. It's costly when you stop a contract while it's underway. We also, there's no lack of need for those improvements. A lot of work's going out, federally eligible work in the paving area, pavement reconstruction and the like. So one of the things that John and his staff have done, looking at how we balance our funding sources to build some cash, and that's what they've been working on. The other thing was about whether we should not advertise future contracts. One of the things that we've talked internally and talked with the industry about is that if we were to say, well, we won't advertise any more work until we're sure what's going to happen at the federal level, this federal solution may come out a couple of weeks, a month, we're not sure. But stopping the production line, it takes about 6 months to restart that. So if I were to stop my advertisement work, when I advertise a project, it's about 6 months before we're actually underway with physical work. It seemed very disruptive to us to do that type of stop-start process. We told industry if this were to linger into the fall, we'd have to look at modifications in terms of the type of contract we put out so that we didn't overextend ourselves. But the comment that I've made to our staff in the industry, we don't want to have this abrupt stop and start process in our program if we can avoid it, because it becomes very disruptive and, frankly, becomes very expensive to our program and to the citizens of Virginia. So they've done a lot of good work here, working on getting reimbursements, federal reimbursements for work that's already occurred. That's what he talks about here with these AC conversions. We're basically able to build some cash coming in to cushion in the event that we get to a prorated reimbursement from the federal government in August and in September.
Yeah, and the reporting to my office will be keeping, obviously, the governor informed as when we think there may be a putting taxpayers at risk. And hopefully, as we know, we think we have 60, 90 days where we're okay with continuing. But if it does linger on by the next time we meet, if we don't have a resolution by the time next time we meet, we're going to have to come to the board to say we're going to have to look at the allocations in the six-year plan. And probably before then, the commissioner will have to take some action internally to slow down the project. So that's really what it is. This is also typically a bonus period where other people don't use their allocation. So this leeway also gives the commissioner the ability, if there are, I don't think there's going to be this year because of the situation, but you never know. Bonus available, which we've enjoyed the last few years, that have that ability. By the way, it's not just the trust fund that's impacted. There are other programs right now that Tiger Grants, TIFIA loans, all those programs have to be looked at too. The most pressing one right now is the Highway Trust Fund, but transit is in jeopardy down the road. These other programs that we enjoy the benefits from. So it looks like for the next 7 or 8 months, it's going to be one of those, keeping things going, but keeping your eye on what's out in the future until they put a reauthorize the legislation and offer some better long-term solutions.
All right, that's all I had. I apologize for not following Mr. Motley's time period.
Yes,
Mr. Rosen. It was going back a little, which is why I waited once we got past it. I noticed on slides 6 and 7, percentage and dollar allocations, local assistance to localities largely took the largest percentage hit and dollar hit. First question is, how much of that local assistance is revenue sharing money? And the second question is, if it is revenue sharing money, isn't that an area where it's a 2-for-1 if we can get a locality to put in half the money?
You're looking at 6 and 7?
Is that correct?
Well, revenue sharing, it falls in the construction program, so it wouldn't be in the local assistance area. What you're seeing here in terms of reduced spending or in some of your PL programs and other things that are funded within that area. So it's not that funding was reduced, it's that the spending just didn't materialize.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lawson. Ms. Stock.
Good afternoon, Mr. Secretary and distinguished board members. I'm Emily Stock with the Department of Rail and Public Transportation. Sorry about that. I'm here to talk about the Southeast High-Speed Rail Richmond Area to Potomac Segment Tier 2 Environmental Impact Statement. And as with any government project, we've got an alphabet soup of acronyms for our EIS, and you all are familiar with most of them. Southeast High Speed Rail, sometimes referred to as CSER, and then RAPS is Richmond Area to Potomac River Segment. So that's a subset of CSER, and our project limits are Centralia, which is south of Richmond, to the Potomac River, and we make that distinction not going all the way to D.C. because there is a project just north of us, the Long Bridge rail project, which is going through environmental process through D.C. Department of Transportation. And there is a map on your, for those of you CTV members, there's a map that's blown up to 11 by 17 that I handed out earlier. I've got additional copies right over here on this table for anyone else who's interested. And I think you all are familiar with the other acronyms. Presentation objectives today. The project hasn't officially kicked off, so we wanted to get in front of the CTB sooner rather than later to provide background and current status of the study, to provide an overview of the corridor, and to describe the role of the CTB as the project continues in decision-making. Also to describe the interagency coordination process. It's a little bit different for a rail project than it is for a highway project, and to review project timeline and next steps. For background purposes, Southeast High Speed Rail is just an element of a broader plan by the United States Department of Transportation in the states to develop a nationwide high-speed intercity rail network. And intercity is an important distinction. One component of a nationwide intermodal intercity transportation network is the intercity high-speed passenger rail, and it's meant to connect two commuter facilities, but it's actually an intercity system. So it's meant to go from CBD to CBD, Central Business District to Central Business District generally, and also connect to Amtrak's Northeast Corridor in the case of Southeast High Speed Rail, which is currently undergoing a multi-state EIS effort. The purpose of the Southeast High Speed Rail project is to offer competitive transportation modes that will divert travelers from air and auto travel within the corridor. And this Southeast High Speed Rail does have a long history, goes all the way back to ICE-T in 1991, signed by President Bush. And in 1992, the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor was designated as one of the five original national high-speed rail corridors. And then a Tier 1 study, environmental impact statement, was begun back in 1999 for the full corridor between Washington, D.C. and Charlotte, North Carolina. And so there have been many offshoots of that original Tier 1 study. Things have been expanded. Southeast High Speed Rail goes all the way to Florida now, and different segments are in different levels of NEPA investigation right now, and some have reached the Tier 2 status. Others are still getting started in feasibility studies. So this slide gives you an idea of the maturity of the different segments of the corridor. I do want to mention Hampton Roads. Hampton Roads was added to the high-speed rail network, to the Southeast High-Speed Rail Network, and a Tier 1 was completed for Richmond to Hampton Roads back in 2012. And that was done between the Tier 1 and Tier 2 studies for Washington down to Charlotte. And the Tier 1 Richmond to Hampton Roads study recommended three new round trips for high-speed rail along what's known as the South Side Corridor from Norfolk up to Petersburg, and one new round trip for conventional rail from Newport News to Richmond. And we're getting ready to start the Tier 2 for RAPS from Richmond to D.C. this year. And then the Tier 2 from Raleigh to Richmond is a project that we've been working on with the state of North Carolina for quite a few years, and we're getting ready to wrap up that Tier 2 segment in 2015. So this, as you know, this is a tiered process, and it's very similar to that that's done for highway projects. And Tier 1 is considered a program-level document. The Tier 1 in this case identified a swath generally co-located with the existing CSX right-of-way that was outlined in the last slide. And as you can see on your map, Tier 2 will identify specific improvements to satisfy the purpose and need, and we'll be designing rail improvements for 30% and securing preliminary permits. This effort will lay the groundwork for final design and permitting and right-of-way acquisition. And the results of the Tier 1 study showed that we should, it recommended an incremental development approach in the corridor that minimizes impacts by using the existing right-of-way. And it also adds 4 new high-speed rail round trips to the corridor, adding that to the existing 10 conventional round trips that we have in the corridor now. It also reduces expected initial capital investment by staying within the corridor and using as many of the infrastructure assets that we have now as possible, and it does generate benefits of higher speeds in an achievable time frame. And then another part of the Tier 1, of course, was to make recommendations for the Richmond to Raleigh segment. South of Richmond, the recommendation was to use CSX's formerly active S-Line, which generally follows the I-85 interstate corridor to Raleigh, south from Petersburg. So when we talk about incremental improvements in rail improvement language, we're talking about these types of improvements that are listed on this slide. And so these are the types of incremental improvements that were recommended by the Tier 1, a corridor-wide additional mainline track to follow the existing right-of-way of CSX's main lines. And so in many sections of the corridor, that means a third track. In some segments that are farther north in the corridor, a fourth track. And we would stay within the current right-of-way or as close as we can get it. Another element of incremental improvements is to straighten curves for higher speeds throughout the corridor. We would also look at sidings and signal improvements to allow for efficient passing. And the most efficient use of all three tracks for both freight and passenger rail. And it's important to note that freight and passenger rail would be using all three tracks. So we'd be increasing the speeds and the maximum allowable speed for passenger rail, but that those would still be shared use corridors. And then, of course, another element of incremental improvements is to improve grade crossing safety. And many of those at-grade highway and rail crossings throughout the corridor are closed in the Northern Virginia area. They're either underpasses or overpasses. We'd be looking at the whole corridor and looking at safety issues surrounding at-grade road and rail crossings. These are some of the steps that we're going to be taking as part of the Tier 2 analysis. The Tier 2 early screening will consider potential alignments outside of the rail right-of-way. We are looking at a couple of segments that were also considered in the Tier 1 that could slightly vary from that existing CSX right-of-way. But that would those alternatives would likely come out through initial screening. Most of the detailed analysis that we'll be doing will be conducted in 5 to 20 mile sub-segments So we'll be looking at putting those incremental improvements that I described earlier in smaller segments and deciding among alternatives in a smaller area. So large-scale greenfield designs or speeds that are above 110 miles an hour are outside of the Tier 2 scope. Those are things that were considered in the Tier 1, and that's the direction that we're taking as prescribed by FRA's high-speed rail policy and the recommendations that were made in the Tier 1. And with regard to speeds, the return on investment we found through the Tier 1 process for speeds above 110 just isn't there. We found that incremental operational improvements that I described before can provide better on-time and consistent performance for passenger rail. And we find that the best combination for the most efficient passenger rail system is a combination of higher speeds and operational improvements.
Chairman?
Mr. Williams?
And I may be wrong, please correct me if I am. Currently, the freight has priority on the rails. If we go to three and make a huge public investment in essence, a privately held rail line, are they going to use all three? We're going to use all three. Is that going to continue?
Would we have one line that we had priority on?
I might let our COO answer that. Kevin Page, he does all the negotiations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Williams, the way we are going to handle the incremental improvements in this project is that we will go in an RTC model, which is rail traffic control model, the corridor. The freight railroad has control of the railroad today. There are 80 trains in the corridor, but only 20 of those are freight. The other 60 are either VRE trains or Amtrak trains. What we will do is develop a program and project schedule based on 95% on-time performance for passenger rail and also set the priorities in that modeling to make sure that the improvements that we will come forward with will give us the priority of train slots and improvements that will be necessary for us to run more dedicated and also more dependable and effective train service. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Cole.
Will the move to higher speed require new locomotive equipment?
Yes, most likely.
Everyone realizes that in this corridor we're running on not our tracks, right? Obviously, right. So we are subservient to the freight. When you normally talk to people, high speed rail are looking at these very, very high speeds, but the investment necessary to get that return is what this study's going to look at, but we're not looking at what's envisioned by most of the public traveling at 220 miles an hour.
And one thing to keep in mind is that CSX is a funding partner. I'll talk about the funding a little bit later in the presentation. These improvements and the improvements that we make in partnership with the host railroads throughout the state benefit both freight and passenger. And so in the course of making these investments together, there are train slots that we would negotiate for, and so the priority is a joint priority as well. The activities that we carry out as part of our Tier 2 EIS are very similar to those that you're familiar with FHWA and FTA projects. We still go through the purpose and need process. We're generally going to be following the purpose and need that was laid out as part of the Tier 1 effort. Since it has been over a decade since the Tier 1 was complete, there may be some updates and adjustments that are made based on current conditions. And so through the scoping process, both agency and public scoping, we'll be reviewing some of those items. And some of the themes of the purpose and need from the Tier 1, the purpose of the project is to provide a competitive transportation choice for travelers, and to ease existing and future conditions, congestion conditions. Safety and energy effectiveness is another purpose of the project. Air quality increases and just increases in overall transportation system efficiency. And so the passenger rail service that we'll be looking at here is meant to enhance the transportation network and really be an option for people above and beyond air travel or interstate travel. As part of our NEPA interagency coordination, the lead agency in this case is the Federal Railroad Administration. That's where our funding is coming from. The bulk of our funding is coming from. And this is just straight NEPA interagency coordination that you all, I'm sure, are familiar with. Because of the unique nature of passenger rail, we're going to be tweaking it slightly. And so I'll get to that in just a second. Of course, this slide outlines our interagency coordination. Like I said, FRA is the lead federal agency. DRPT is the lead state agency. We're also going to be working with what's known as a core team, the RAPS task force, which is made up of the host railroad, CSX, and operators, both VRE and Amtrak. VDOT will be another member of the RAPS task force. And so these groups are all going to be working together, and that's another layer of coordination that you don't typically see on a NEPA study because of that shared use. And so we have reached out already to some of the localities in the corridor. We've sent out invitations to speak with each one of the counties in the corridor and cities in the corridor, and many of them have taken our team up on that even before we have a consultant under contract. We've met with Arlington, Fairfax, Stafford, Hanover, Henrico, Richmond, and Chesterfield so far. And if any of the localities that you all are familiar with or are interested in hearing more about the project even before it starts, we're happy to speak with others. This slide shows the corridor overview, and of course you have a more detailed version of this at your desk. And outlines where some of those incremental improvements that were identified in the Tier 1 study have a best fit. So these are the improvements that we'll be analyzing throughout the Tier 2 study. And it is about a 115-mile segment. And like I said before, it extends from the Potomac River just south of Long Bridge down to Centralia, which is south of Richmond. This is our draft timeline. Our goal is to get this project done, get the study done within 3 years. We realize that that's an aggressive timeline, and we're working with our team, and we'll be working with our consulting team to achieve a streamlined timeline. And of course you'll see that the planning tasks are in dark blue at the top of the timeline. We've got engineering, and this project does have engineering to 30%, environmental, and then public involvement is the green section. We'll have a number of public meetings, and for each series of public meetings, we will have sessions both in Northern Virginia, in the Fredericksburg region, and in Richmond. So they'll be held in series of three throughout the study to reach all three districts locally. And then the yellow stars that you see at the bottom are RAPS task force meetings, and those will happen throughout the project.
Have we been working on this before now?
There's been ongoing coordination. The major set of activities right now have really dealt with the coordination with FRA and with CSX and Amtrak, and then also with developing the procurement documents and the scope of work, and then getting our consultant under contract, which we expect to happen in the next month or so.
Right, so
it's been a long road, and we'll talk. I think our next slide will be talking about the budget, and I probably want to go to that, Emily. But the A major portion of this is being funded by FRA, so a lot of this has been the coordination with FRA, which has taken a while.
But we're steady on this, is my yes. point. Now, I mean, is it really going to take another 5 years?
Well, as Emily mentioned, we're saying 3 to 4. Yeah.
Well, it's 3 to 5, but I mean, it just seems a long, long process. And how long has it taken for us to get from Raleigh to Richmond?
It's been over 8 years.
8 years. Yeah. And we wonder why we don't get a lot of construction done. Well, I would just encourage us. I think this is one we're going to make the commitment to get this completed during this administration.
So that's
what we're going to do.
One of the things that we've done, just so you know.
I know we're not the lead agency. But
yeah, a lot of this will be dictated by FRA. One of the things that we have done is we're creating a dedicated project team, which is going to be led by Emily and a couple other DRPT staff as well, so that we'll be able to focus our resources on implementing this and accelerating the timeline as much as possible. But there are some practical limits, and it is a 115-mile corridor with a lot of coordination.
Well, I would just make sure. If it's us holding us up, we shouldn't.
Yeah.
If it's the federal authorities, I would like to be notified so that we can maybe push this along a little bit.
Yeah.
I think we should set an objective that we're going to have this signed during this administration.
Well, I agree with that. I think it's just so important, and it just seems that it drags on and for years and years, 8 years.
Yeah, So that's next. Let's update our graph when we do it again to say that we're going to have it. Look, if we don't set it, we're not going to, this will hold us to it.
And I appreciate that direction, Secretary Lane, and I appreciate the support of this body certainly as we go forward. This is a decision-making body as part of this study, and we will be looking for direction from you on our recommended alternative, and so we hope to stay in close contact and make sure that you're aware of the issues as we go forward and can help us with those decision points to make sure that we stick to a 3-year schedule. And this next slide is our budget slide. As you can see, FRA high-speed rail funding is covering about 80%. Is covering 80% of the project at a little over $44 million. We have a 20% match responsibility. DRPT is covering that out of its rail enhancement fund, a little over $8 million. And we also have a commitment from CSX for 5% at almost $3 million. So our next steps, right now we are in negotiations with a consulting team. So we are finalizing procurement, and that's both for the environmental impact statement and for 30% preliminary engineering. We hope to issue an NTP soon and hold a project kickoff meeting with our team. And the next formal outreach to the CTB will be NEPA project scoping. So please stay tuned for that. And we also ask that you reach out to us at any time. This is our internal RAPS project team at DRPT that you see up on the slide now and our contact information. I'm fortunate to be joined as RAPS project manager by two deputy project managers, both Michael Todd and Jacob Craig, who can't make it today, and also have a team of senior advisors, Director Mitchell, Kevin Page, who is DRPT COO, and Amy Inman, the Planning and Mobility Programs Administrator. So that's the conclusion of my talk, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. But let's adjust this timetable and just stay informed. Let's really try to make that, or we will make that.
So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brule.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board.
Good afternoon.
Very brief presentation for you today. At the beginning of the meeting, the chairman mentioned that our next meeting is in September, and it will be in Roanoke. and it's going to be held in conjunction with our local programs workshop, so I wanted to give you a little bit of a briefing on what that workshop is all about and what you can expect to see while you're in Roanoke. As was evidenced by the actions the board took last month in terms of programs like revenue sharing, where we're leveraging a significant amount of money with our local partners, our relationship with local governments has really evolved and changed over the past few years. It's financial, but it's also very heavily focused on project delivery. 42% of the projects scheduled to be advertised over the next 3 years are being managed by localities. So it's very important, and we recognize a real significant need to get together on a regular basis with our local partners. And we started that back in 2012 by holding our first local programs workshop. What we thought would be a pretty small gathering grew pretty quickly. We've had 350 attendees each year. We've held it in 2012 and 2013 in Richmond. We've had representatives of local government, state agencies, federal agencies, and private industry that have participated and joined us for those last two discussions, both of which have shared the common theme, Network for Success, that by getting together, working in partnership, we can successfully deliver transportation programs for the Commonwealth. To give you a little idea of what the workshop itself looks like, it's a lot of moving parts and pieces. We have a couple of plenary sessions where we bring all 350-plus folks together, talk about major transportation issues, but we also do a number of breakout sessions where we're breaking into four concurrent sessions, basically groups between 75 and 100 people getting into more nuts and bolts issues related to transportation. Our tracks for 2014 are on the screen, but basically we have a little bit of something for everyone who might be involved in transportation, from the administrator's perspective to details of project development, construction, and we also offer a boot camp track for folks that may be new to local programs and working and partnering with VDOT. So what does this mean to the board? Well, the board September meeting will be held at the Hotel Roanoke, which is where the local programs workshop will be held. In terms of scheduling the board, the workshop meeting will be on Tuesday morning, which will give us an opportunity that I'll share with you in a second. The action meeting will be on Wednesday morning, which will be just before our opening plenary session for the local programs workshop. We're working out all the logistics. Carol will communicate all the details with you prior to the meeting. But we put together a really interesting agenda, and we have some new things that we're trying this year, largely because we've worked with a host committee of local representatives from the Roanoke Valley and from the New River Valley, from the city of Roanoke, that have brought together a really interesting opportunity that we want to share with the board.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Rose,
just one comment. At some point, William and I were talking about it the last few days. At some point, if we could discuss maybe some things that William and I think would be good to include in, or talk about what's being included, because there may be some things that while we're in that area, it'd be good to see for the board, just as we did.
Oh, you mean for the, not for the workshop, but okay, for the board meeting. Yeah. Yes, get with Ms. Mathis, Carol.
Meeting.
Yeah. Yes, get with Carol and... certainly, anything y'all want to entertain us with, we'll be more than happy to.
More regional than specific.
Sure.
In locality.
Sure.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
After the board workshop on Tuesday morning, we're going to have a series of mobile workshops for our attendees. And this is the first time that we've done this. They're very multimodal in nature. Ms. Mathis will send out a list. If you're interested in participating in any of these, we can certainly accommodate that. We're going to have a tour by bicycle to greenways and bike routes in the city of Roanoke, many of which have been funded by this board through the Transportation Enhancement and Transportation Alternatives Program. We're going to have a bus tour of various bicycle, pedestrian, highway, and transit projects in the Roanoke Valley region. We've got a walking tour of several downtown museums and projects that have had either VDOT funding through our traditional urban construction program or through the Transportation Alternatives and Transportation Enhancement programs. And then not directly related to local programs, but we have also arranged to have a tour of the Smart Road facility that's operated by Virginia Tech. I actually got to go out there for the first time in March, and it is quite impressive. So that's another opportunity that we're making available to our attendees and to the board.
Now, are these concurrent, or can we go to more than one?
Unfortunately, these are concurrent.
Well, I would think the smart road is something we all ought to see, and there might be. I would set it up if we could do this that we go all the group go the smart road, and then let the other three be chosen. You know, what you're so. But I think it would be important for the board. Well, that's one of the things that the commissioner and I and we're going to be doing is going to these facilities and understanding what we're funding and what we're getting. And I would like the board certainly to see what the smart road is. This technology is going to be a big part of House Bill 2. We have to use certain percentage of that in that, so I think it would be great. Right, so.
Please, Mr. Chairman, just because we're talking about this, that Hap and I went on a tour. Was that 2 weeks ago, Hap, that we went on the tour of the smart road? And it's an interesting project, definitely worth seeing. Some of the technology they're working on is incredible, including all the smart cars. But the other kind of interesting dynamic is you'll see the road, which was largely publicly funded, but is really sort of privately used right now. So I think there's a legitimate discussion about whether that road should ever be connected to where it was intended to be connected, given the investment in use at this time.
Being a good representative of your area, so yeah, absolutely. But I think we should all go. We should go. And that, yeah, absolutely.
Just to give you a quick glance at what the workshop itself looks like, the board meeting, the action meeting, will be on Wednesday morning, with the goal of concluding prior to the start of the plenary session, which starts at 10 o'clock. We are very fortunate to have the Secretary, the Commissioner, and Director Mitchell on our opening plenary session, along with Deputy Secretary Donahue, who's going to talk about prioritization with our local partners. So we hope that you'll be able to join us, especially for that opening session, and maybe stay through lunch. We've got, for those of you that really don't want to miss out on the opportunity to bike while you're there or possibly walk some of the greenways, the Reno Valley Greenway Group is going to plan some early morning outings for Wednesday morning and Thursday morning as well to go out and take advantage of the many opportunities from a multimodal perspective that are close by to the Hotel Roanoke. So with that, just wanted to give you a little bit of insight of kind of the synergy that happened when we found out that the board was going to be out there in September, and we were planning to be out there in September, and look forward to having you join us on the 16th. Be happy to answer any questions. Registration is going very well so far.
So. It's pretty exciting. I think this will be a good couple of days out in the Roanoke area. So anyway,
thank you.
Thank you. I think that concludes our workshop session. I think we've discussed everything that we need to for the action agenda. I think I'm correct on that. Let me call the action agenda up, and with that. I'll call to order the action agenda for the July meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Our first order of business.